It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Fight me.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
This is my third show this year so far after my Dynamite live stream and my Wrestle Kingdom review for night one, but the first official sound off of the new year. Now entering my third decade doing this, and I thank you for joining me for the ride. This is episode 633 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, January 5th, 2020. I am the Solid Monster. Wrestle Kingdom 14 is in the books. I have not yet watched night two, though I did watch night one. I have a 40-minute review up for that right now on the YouTube channel. I will likely be doing a separate review for night two later on today. In the meantime, this is a spoiler-free zone, and I'm also going to be recording a video for YouTube ranking who I think were the top five wrestlers for the last decade. I've had this in my back pocket for a couple of weeks now, and hopefully later today I'll get around to actually recording it. I don't want to wait anymore. I want to get this out and share it with all of you, and hopefully that will be going up in the next few days. There's other decade-related things that I have listed and I have ranked, and it's just a matter of figuring out how and when to record it and release it, but the wrestler of the decade and top five wrestlers of the decade, hopefully you will be seeing that on YouTube in the coming days. So that is also something to watch for. If you want to become a PayPal VIP and support this podcast here in 2020, you may do so. Just go to thesolidmonster.com. PayPal button's on the right-hand side of the page. And you can, it's a completely voluntary thing. If you'd like to donate in some way, $10 or more, we'll get you a special little nickname. Which, by the way, I've had a couple people ask me, hey, do you give out the nicknames? I do in most cases, just because people don't give me their own. And so if there's no field for you to fill that in when you send the PayPal in, you can just email me separately and let me know who you are, and so I can connect everything. And you can make your own suggestions. If for some reason it's already taken, I'll let you know. But by all means, after so long trying to come up with names every week, I do appreciate it when people have their own contributions. So yes, you can suggest a name if you would like. So this is the first roll call of the new decade. Here we go. New York punk Arnold Modesto with the first donation of the new decade. See, Arnold now becomes a trivia note here in the Sound Off history. The Bangkok Bandit, Nipit Viramatikal, one of the biggest supporters of this show. Happy New Year, my friend. Deadpool James Herrera, another longtime friend of the show, back with us again here for the new year. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton. John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Pissera, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Killshot Keith Hart, Luis Hercules Hernandez, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, and I hope that Mama Eichard is doing better. I know she was in the hospital, so you can tell her that the monster is thinking about her. Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Pull No Punches Alan Ragasa, Deathblow David Floyd, Josh the Shooter Stockton, celebrating a birthday today, so happy birthday to Josh. Oscar the Oofman Hernandez, shout out to him and his wife Jenny. They are celebrating their one-year wedding anniversary today. He says they will be celebrating with dinner with friends, a little bit of the bubbly, and the sound-off. Well, make sure you do it in that order. Don't do the sound-off first, or else we'll be celebrating your first divorce, and we don't want to do that. We want you to celebrate year two, three, four, and five of your marriage, and not the other thing, so thank you for that. Stephen Handyman Hallis, that reminds me of when I was in New Orleans, right? Remember we were in New Orleans, me and Noah, we crashed the Norwegian wedding and we interviewed the new couple. They were fans of the podcast and we knew they were getting married and, you know, they just decided to do it in New Orleans over WrestleMania 30 weekend. No family there on either side. So we decided we're going to be their family. We showed up and it was a lovely ceremony and I remember interviewing them for the podcast, a little segment outside the church. This Norwegian church, I believe it was, or establishment. And I made the comment. I said, you know, hey, I brought up Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, and things got kind of dark there, and Noah yelled at me for it. But, you know, hey, look, these things happen. Got to be realistic about these things, right? But I have faith. I have faith that Oscar and his lovely bride are going to be just fine. Stephen Handyman Halistick, thank you. Vicious Vincent Cooper, Max the Axe Velado, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Project Zero Mortals, Wayne Ashanti, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Maniac Moderator, Jeff Lipman, Scott the Stump Woodford, Tough as Nails, Nicholas Morgan, the best, the best, the best, Christian Ortiz, and Raymond M. Thank you all for the PayPal support. Also, got a shout out to a couple of folks from iTunes who left reviews for the show. AOTFTW, who has been listening since 2011. Thank you for your review on iTunes. And Chase Pock, who discovered the show in the last couple of years from one of the shows that I guest hosted with Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch. In fact, I was just on with Wade again on Friday, funny enough, talking SmackDown. He says, I've been missing out. This is the best weekly roundup of wrestling you will find. I stopped watching WWE altogether because it's awful right now. Thank you for suffering for us gluttonous WWE fans who are over 35 years into the product and just can't make a clean break. Well, I aim to please. You're not the only one I've heard that from. So thank you. Dando is a fan of the show. He hosts the Four Finger Podcast, the Four Finger Discount Podcast, to be exact, which is a show all about The Simpsons. He lives down in Geelong, Australia. He wrote in to tell us that their beautiful country is currently on fire. Literally. They're having some awful brush fires down there, you may have heard. Or maybe you didn't hear about it, because frankly, these stories don't get a whole lot of play outside of the usual noise that you'll see on TV and whatnot. So as such, Dando wanted to make us aware that his show, they are donating 50% of his podcast's monthly income from Patreon to the RSPCA Bushfire Appeal. I don't know if he meant brush fire, but the RSPCA Brushfire Appeal, RSPCA NSW, so you know, is a nonprofit. They treat, protect, rehome animals all across Australia. So if you're an animal lover, if you're an ASPCA supporter, for example, here in this country, this might speak to you. I love animals. I hate seeing, animals, they're completely defenseless in situations like this. And a lot of times, because people's lives are in danger, you don't always think of the dogs and the cats and all the other animals. So that is what they do. If you're interested in Simpsons, if you're interested in Futurama podcast content, and also want to help out these animals, one way is to subscribe to their Patreon, patreon.com/fourfingerdiscount, or you can just help directly at rspcansw.org/bushfireappeal. I think it is bushfire. It's bushfire-appeal is the website that you can go to. Audible is still giving listeners of this podcast a free 30-day trial of their service, as many of you have taken me up on this offer over the years. They are kind enough to have extended this into the new year. And there's three different offerings that you could take advantage of right now and get one free book for. You just go to audibletrial.com/solemnmonsters. Sign up for the trial. You've got to go through the sign-up process. It is free to try for 30 days. During that trial phase, you can cash in on one free audiobook that you get to keep no matter what. It's yours forever. Mayor Kane by Glenn Jacobs, narrated by Jacobs himself. You all know about that. But you also may not know that Hornswoggle has, from what I've read, is a pretty good book out. Life is Short and So Am I, under his real name, Dylan Postal. It's narrated by Horny himself. And you could also pre-order, if you would like, Jim Ross's next book, Under the Black Hat. You can pre-order that for free right now as well. The book doesn't actually become available. It doesn't come out until March 31st, so you have some time. But you can pre-order it now and just, it's like set it and forget it. You'll get it for free, and then when the book drops, you can read it on your device. So get any of those for free, any one of those books. Just sign up, audibletrial.com/solemnmonster. Shout out to Zach in the Facebook group, Zach Holker. He is handling all of the logistics of the latest Royal Rumble pool, the annual pool. This is the 7th annual one in our private Facebook group. So far, we have over 1,700 people signed up, now climbing towards 1,800. I don't know if we'll break the record from last year. Last year was just out of control. Last year was crazy. We had over 2,400 signups last year. I think we'll break 2,000 easily. I don't know about 2,400, but if you want to get in on the fun, you can go ahead and sign up. Prizes will be awarded to the first, second, and third place winners of the final pool after the Rumble pay-per-view. You can't participate unless you're in the group. So you first have to apply for membership to be approved for entry into the Facebook group. Just type in Solid Monster Sounds Off. You should be able to find it. You have to answer a couple of questions and then get approved. Each person gets a random number to be issued by Zach in a few weeks. That number will be your number for both the men's and women's Royal Rumble matches. And if you win your pool, however many dozen pools there end up being, because it's 30 people per pool. That's how it works. And if we go over the number 30, it spills over into another pool. When you win your respective pool, you then move on to the ultimate, the final Royal Rumble pool. And that is where the three winners will be selected. And so how do you enter? Once you're in the group, very simple. All you got to do, look for Zach's Rumble pool post. It's pinned in the announcement section up top. And just click like. That's all you got to do. Just like the post. You don't even have to comment. Like the post, and you are in. And the deadline to enter ends just a few hours before the pay-per-view on Royal Rumble Sunday. That's January 26th. So hopefully we'll see you there. I'm always in there. I'm always in the Rumble pool myself. You know, you want to eliminate the Solid Monster. You can only do that by getting on in the fun here. Now, I can't win any of the prizes, of course, for obvious reasons. That would be a little suspect, right? That would be a little unfair. But I always get in on the action. I actually won, at least my pool, I won 1 year. I think it was at Randy Orton. Might have been in 2017 when he won the Rumble match. But like the year before or something, I had gold dust. So as soon as I saw him walk out, I knew I was fucked. You know, it's just, you never know. You never know what's going to happen. Hopefully I'll get a Samoa Joe or a Kevin Owens this year or a Roman Reigns and not a Mojo Rawley. On Observer Radio last week, Dave Meltzer claimed that there has been a change in the relationship, or lack thereof, between New Japan Pro Wrestling and All Elite Wrestling. Whereas before, the door was slammed pretty firmly shut on the two sides working together, having any kind of working relationship. Apparently, in light of New Japan, it's funny how this works. They lost their television here in the States after Anthem booted them off of Access TV. All of a sudden, it sounds like the lines of communication might be opening, at least a little bit. Now, that does not mean they're working together, only that they are open to talking at some point. Now, I'm also recording this right now at this moment without having looked at any of the spoilers or having watched any of Night 2 of Wrestle Kingdom, which has the Chris Jericho-Hiroshi Tanahashi match. If Tanahashi won, then I guess that would be as good of an indication yet of the two sides being open to working together. I had predicted Jericho winning. I don't think there's too much smoke to the fire here, but I guess I'll find out in a few hours when I'm done with this and I go watch the show. But Meltzer, he went to Japan for the shows. And, I mean, that must be like a religious pilgrimage for him. And he sounded the other night a lot less enthusiastic about the idea of the two sides working together, in that the problems that they would need to overcome from New Japan's perspective are bigger than he thought. Now, I don't know who he talked to. You know, there's any number of people, you know, with AEW, obviously, that he's friendly with, and probably New Japan as well. So if that's coming from somebody on the inside, that doesn't sound like a very good sign. So that's the update on the whole AEW-New Japan situation. Until something is said officially, the reality is that nobody knows nothing for sure. It's a very odd situation. I still think that there's benefits on both sides to working together in some way. But there's still a lot of hurdles, it seems like, to overcome. But don't underestimate the power of a company that's looking to expand into this country and has no TV. They no longer have TV in this country. They have New Japan World. On demand. Streaming service. That's it. That's all they've got. You want to expand your footprint here in this country, the only way to do that, you need TV. So if there is no agreement between them, I still say before this year is out, there will be, because there almost has to be. What other option is there? You know, New Japan losing its television here in the U.S. was a big story, but how and why it happened, which we got a few more details on that this week, is just, Hey, well, it's exactly what you would probably expect. New Japan was under the impression, apparently, that they had another year on access before they might get booted from the station. So they were very much cognizant of the fact that, hey, we might not be on this network for that much longer, but we at least have 2020. So we have the year to worry about it and either negotiate or negotiate somewhere else. So at least we have a landing spot if we get taken off of Access TV. That's what they were thinking. They were not prepared to lose their television a year in advance. Allegedly, Anthem suggested that, I don't know if this was stated directly or if this was kind of done with a wink and a nod, but Anthem said you can stay if you're willing to work with us, if you're willing to work with Impact, some kind of working relationship. And when New Japan balked and said no, they got the axe. New Japan said no quid pro quo to Anthem. And that was it. The relationship was over. So, pretty much how I think a lot of people would have expected the explanation to be for this is it sounds like that's exactly what happened here. Speaking of Impact, Impact Wrestling has its Hard to Kill pay-per-view. Hard to Kill is a very apt name for Impact Wrestling. As long as they've been around for and all of the struggles they've had over the years and the different regimes and bouncing from one network in one night of the week to the next, they are in fact Hard to Kill. So a very appropriate title for their pay-per-view. That's coming up next Sunday, January 12, I believe it is. Tessa Blanchard challenging Sami Callihan for the Impact World title. A few weeks ago on Impact, Sami and Tessa had a giant brawl that spilled out into the streets of New York City. I only knew this because I saw the clip spreading. It was going viral on social media. Because I don't watch Impact week to week anymore like I used to. And so I saw the clip, and I saw the other day that the clip has since racked up over 4 million. In fact, it could be closer to 5 million by now, because this was a few days ago. It has racked up well over 4 million Facebook views. Now, I say the same thing whenever WWE has a video that racks up millions of views on YouTube, and you get these people who say, oh, well, you know, obviously this segment is fantastic because it got 3 million views or it got 5 million views. Yeah, it's fantastic, I guess, if they're making ad money off the video on YouTube. I have no idea, you know, if there's some kind of flat fee they get paid. I have no idea how WWE is making money off YouTube. I'm sure they are. You know, I don't know the system or the structure that they have in place. So in that respect, yeah, that's a great thing for them. But I always laugh because they will post segments that are really entertaining sometimes, that rack up a lot of views. And they'll also post stuff on YouTube, on their channel, that is absolute pure dog shit. But somehow, to some people, this is some kind of validation that, see, everybody who didn't like the segment, everybody who said the segment was terrible, they were wrong. No, they weren't. It really all depends on what your definition of a great segment is. When you're watching a segment on WWE television, if you're judging it based on entertainment value, replay value, is it the sort of thing that's going to drive you to watch the show and come back next week, buy that person's t-shirt, buy a ticket to the next show? If you judge it on that criteria, I think that's kind of the way a lot of people look at it. You can absolutely have a horrendous segment that really doesn't serve any purpose other than to just generate some talk online or rack up views. It could still be a shit segment, which I still maintain that wedding was last week. Some people disagree with me. Those people are certainly entitled to be wrong. That's fine. Nobody's perfect. But I think everybody has their own definition of these things. Some people will look at it and go, the only thing that matters is, does it get people talking? Does it generate buzz? If it did, and if it racks up 5 million views, then it was a great segment. That's how they define greatness. And you're never going to get those people to come around to your point of view because the way they look at it and view it is just completely different from the way that you may look at it and from the way that I may look at it. So you can call it whatever you want. I have a word for it. I'll bet my word for it is very different than your word for it. But I'm not going to argue with these people anymore because it's completely pointless. Anyway, so we see that sometimes with WWE videos, right? The question is, what does it translate to? That's what I want to know. 2 million, 5 million, 10 million views. What does it mean? What does it translate to? Does it make more people watch the television show if they see something on Facebook? or on YouTube? It's kind of important, as New Japan is finding out now, to have a television show. You can call it a dying medium. There's social media now. People watch in different ways. Millennial this, millennial that. That's fine. But it's still live and die in a lot of ways. A lot of these promotions do. By their television deal. Go talk to the people that run these companies and say, hey, we're going to take your television away from you. But hey, it's okay because you got a Facebook page, right? You have a YouTube page. You got Google AdSense enabled. You'll be all right. You don't mind, do you? Sure, go ahead. We don't need the television. TV's a dying breed. Go ahead, give it to somebody else. Go see what their reaction is. That's still the most important lifeblood for a lot of companies. You take that away, it's going to hurt them. So you need to make sure that you can get people to tune in to watch your television show. So if that's what this segment does, an impact on access next week goes up by 500,000 viewers, that's, hey, bravo. Bravo to Impact. I'm going to make a prediction now that that will not happen. But that's the question. You know, does it make more people watch the show, buy a ticket? There's no evidence of this. You know, is that video going to make people want to buy the pay-per-view to see Sammy and Tessa? That's the bigger question to me. We'll find out. But that is it's damn impressive. I'm not trying to bash them. I'm actually trying to give them credit here because that's damn impressive that a TV show that you have to think, and I don't think Access releases their ratings information, but you would have to think that having that television show that probably, if they're lucky, scrapes up maybe a few hundred thousand viewers each week. I can't imagine that show gets more than 200,000 to 300,000, if even that. That Impact does those kind of numbers every single week. And the fact that they would get a segment that nets at last count 4.7 million views on Facebook is impressive. You know, that video was posted, if you're saying, well, was it posted a month ago? It's had a month to rack up those views. It was posted on the same day. Or maybe the following morning, but it was the same day as the Lana and Lashley wedding, last Monday. They went up almost at the same time. And that video on WWE's YouTube channel, with 52 million subscribers, had at last count over 4.2 million views. The Tessa video with Sammy has more views than the Lana and Lashley wedding does. And I actually thoroughly enjoyed the Impact segment a lot more than I did that stupid Raw segment. So I got to give Impact their props on that. I don't know what it's going to mean, but that is an impressive number. I don't know if they're putting the title on Tessa or not. But if they do, I would have no problem with it. She looked competitive in there with Sammy. She lost, you know, but in defeat, I thought that they had a damn good match the last time I saw them in the ring together. She was made to look competitive with him, and, you know, I thought she was believable enough in there with Sammy. Now, if Sammy was, you know, 6'5" and 300 pounds, would I feel the same way? Maybe not. I'd have to see the match. I did see a little bit of a match that she had with Brian Cage a few weeks ago. And I felt a little differently about that one. And she pinned him. She beat Cage in the middle of the ring. That was, that was a little bit different for me. But the stuff with her and Sammy is more believable to me than seeing her in there with Brian Cage. So, but it wouldn't bother me if they did a title change. The only critique I have when it comes to the stuff that I've seen Tessa doing is her facial expressions. After those near falls in her matches where she thinks she has the match won and then she doesn't, and they zoom in on her reaction. Now, every wrestler has a reaction. Their eyes bug out of their head or they can't believe it. They all have kind of a similar kind of reaction. But in a lot of her matches, her reactions are so over the top. It's my one knock, really, on Will Ospreay also. The same thing happens in Will Ospreay's matches a lot of the time. And he was my wrestler. I had him pegged as my wrestler of the year last year. But the over-the-top expressions are just way too cartoonish for me. But again, that's a minor critique. If that's my only critique, you know, that's not bad. But yeah, we'll see if they pull the trigger and they do the title change. If they do, you're going to see a lot of very butthurt people online who are going to be very upset. And maybe that's what they're looking for. Maybe they want to get a rise. They want to get a reaction, get people talking like that clip did on Facebook. Because what Impact could use more than anything right now, they need people talking about them and knowing they exist. I don't think I can recall a period of time in the history of this company where it just seems like there's just nothing there. You know, they have some talent. Their PR machine, I get emails from them a lot. So they're doing a good job as far as funneling information out. But as far as just people chattering about Impact on social media, or me getting emails about, now I don't cover Impact a lot on this show, so it kind of makes sense, but it just seems like they can't find a formula that works to really get people talking about them. Maybe that's the goal here. And maybe changing the championship is one way to do that. Sad tweet this week goes to former Ring of Honor star, current AEW employee, BJ Whitmer. I wouldn't even mention this, but since he posted about it himself, this qualifies for sad tweet this week. BJ Whitmer, who married the now former Women of Honor champion in ROH, Kelly Klein, 3 years ago, and stuck up for her during her recent spat with Ring of Honor management, backed up some of her claims, dutifully defending his wife, until he recently learned that she was, according to him, cheating on him. She was going outside of the marriage. And he posted this statement on Twitter. He said, "My wife Kelly Klein and I are divorcing. This is happening because Kelly breached the trust in our relationship by stepping outside of our marriage. This is the only thing I have to say about the matter. This has been a very difficult time for myself and my family. News of our split was already spreading around the business, and I wanted to make a statement before it made it to social media or wrestling media." Now, we only have his side of the story so far, but if it's true, well, I mean, I guess Kelly Klein wasn't a woman of honor after all. After this, you know, AEW, it seems like as a potential landing spot for her, would kind of be a little bit awkward. A little bit awkward. I'm not one to sit here and say, well, she could never end up in AEW now. You know, is she good enough to even go to AEW? Would AEW benefit by having her on the roster? You know, I heard all this great talk about Dr. Britt Baker, you know, who comes across as a bigger star. She's got this great story, she's wrestling, and she's simultaneously running her own dental practice. You know, I'm not impressed when I see her on television each week and I watch her in the ring. I'm still waiting. I'm still waiting to see what the big deal is. Kelly Klein, would she be any better than Dr. Britt Baker? You know, would that women's division really be strengthened by her presence? I don't know. But I'm not one to sit here and say, well, she can't go to AEW because of something that happened in her personal life with someone who happens to work in the same company. Yeah, it would be awkward, but she also shouldn't be shut out of a job because of it, I don't think. But it would seem that that could potentially close one door for her. This also does not make some of the things that she and Joey Mercury said about ROH any less true, especially the things for which Mercury provided evidence of and screenshots for. And those issues should still be addressed. You know, if there's a concern that at some of the shows there isn't the kind of medical help that there needs to be. And, you know, they talked about the situation with Jay Lethal when he broke his arm and other people getting hurt and some of the things that had to be done in lieu of getting actual medical attention to them as quickly as possible. You know, if that's happening, then those things need to be addressed. And it's good that they shined a light on that. So just because this whole thing here has now just devolved into a total shit show should not negate all of the things that Kelly Klein and Joey Mercury were talking about. Now, I don't know who she allegedly cheated on BJ Whitmer with, nor do I care. But one sign may be the alleged text message that Whitmer sent to Joey Mercury from apparently somebody else's phone a few weeks ago, where Whitmer evidently told Mercury, "Go kill yourself, you worthless drug-addled fuck." That's an exact quote from the screenshot. He sounds a tad bit upset, though, doesn't he? He sounds a little bit upset there in that text message. So I don't know if that is an answer for anything or not. Mercury has since been suspended. His account has been suspended by Twitter. I don't know why. Maybe he doxed someone. I don't know what he may have done. Reality is stranger than fiction sometimes. Yeah, this may be more Jerry Springer-like than that wedding on Raw last week. There's actually quite a few options for a sad tweet this week. I also could have gone with Jim Cornette for threatening to quite literally strangle Bruce Mitchell of the Pro Wrestling Torch if he ever saw him in person. Now, he's been threatening Mitchell for probably over 25 years now, since the Smoky Mountain days. This is nothing new. He does not like this man. He even told him straight up on Twitter, I don't like you. And basically, if you and I ever end up in the same place, you're going to find my hand around your throat. He's not too bright putting these threats out there so blatantly on social media, but that's what Cornette does. That's what he does. I think people just kind of are used to it and they kind of brush it off, but he did threaten to basically strangle Bruce Mitchell. So that happened. That was a thing this week. This also was a thing. This other sad tweet that I want to address very briefly here, since my name got dragged into this. It comes from Corey Graves, who was promoting his latest podcast with Renee Young and Michael Cole as his guests. I have not listened to it, but I did read a transcript of the Cole interview, and it actually sounds like a really good one. I may have to listen to, I'll find time hopefully in the next few days to actually listen to the Cole portion at least, especially the stuff where Cole talks about the lead up and the build up to his match with Jerry Lawler at WrestleMania 27, and how they were rehearsing that day, earlier that day, in the ring at the building. I think they were at the Georgia Dome, I believe, that year. So they're in the ring rehearsing for their match earlier in the day. And CM Punk, out of nowhere, catches Cole with a totally random running knee right to the jaw. And he knocked out Cole's front tooth, which, you know, Punk very quickly, oh, I'm so sorry. He apologized for it. He said he offered to pay for his dental work. I'm trying to picture this in my head. Did Punk just not know that Cole was there and he just randomly goes running around the ring with flying knees? I need some kind of reenactment of this. I'm trying to visualize this in my head, and I laugh. It's funny every single time I try to think about how this actually happened. But Cole was very worried because he was calling the show on commentary up to the point that he had to get in the ring and wrestle. So he was pulling double duty that night. He was commentating, and he was wrestling. He was performing, or I don't know if wrestling is the word I would use for what he did, but he was performing in the ring that night. So he was very worried. I have a missing tooth now. What the hell am I going to do? Which I guess they got it fixed up. And then apparently during the match, he claims that Lawler on a drop kick knocked his other front tooth out. Now, I have no interest in going back and reliving that match. I'll take him at his word. I'll take his word for it. Anyway, someone replied to a tweet that Graves posted. He was promoting the episode. And someone replied with a tweet tagging, I think it was Wade Keller, Joe Cronin, and myself. And he said that I would rather listen to, you know, these three guys talk about wrestling and not some WWE company shill. I don't advocate doing that. You know, the man is tweeting stuff from his own account and then tweeting him and having nothing to do with what he's tweeting about. You know, the man has his own show to promote. If you want to listen to somebody else, I don't think you got to rub it in the guy's face, you know, but thank you. I'm glad you enjoy my content. I think that's awesome, but I don't think you need to start doing shit like that. But Corey responded. He took the bait and he responded and he said, I'm sure they would actually love to work for the company. I'm sorry you hate truth. And I love this mentality that everybody who either watches WWE or, I guess, talks about WWE, does a radio show, if you're like one of the Busted Open guys, or if you have a podcast, if you have a YouTube show, I can tell you that there are plenty of podcasters and YouTubers and people who write articles on wrestling news websites who would give their left nut to work for WWE. There's a lot of people out there who aspire to one day draw a paycheck from the very man that they bash every single week and seem to utterly despise, but they would happily take a check signed by Vince McMahon. So he's not totally wrong in the idea that there are people like that that do exist. But the way, you know, this tweet, I read this tweet that I'm tagged in, and I just love this mentality that whoever you are, if you're talking about WWE, you must aspire to work for WWE. The only reason that you're even doing this is because one day you're going to get that phone call. You're going to get that direct message. You're going to get your foot in the door somehow. Maybe you can deliver coffee, you know, to the folks in the tower. Maybe that's how you get your foot in the door. Everybody must feel this way. It was his dream. It was Corey's dream to work for WWE. And now he does. And so it must be everyone else's dream too. So I will repeat what I said on Twitter. I said, Corey, don't be an ass. I am quite content doing my own thing. I have two jobs, I have two jobs right now that are keeping me very busy. Busier than I would like to be. But they do a very good job of paying the bills. I assure you, I am not lobbying for any more jobs. Anyone who has listened to this podcast, it's laughable to me that anybody who has listened to this podcast for any length of time, and I actually think I'm you know, pretty fair and even-handed most of the time when it comes to talking about just stuff in general. Yeah, I get negative and I bash stuff when it deserves it. Not just for the sake of doing it, not because it's a gimmick, not because it's going to get clicks and views. When there's stuff to praise, I praise, because I love wrestling. And when I hate wrestling, for whatever reason, and there are lots of times and lots of segments that make me rethink why the hell I even do this, guess what? I'm going to talk about it. And if that bothers people, too bad. Some of the things I've said, the people who have listened to these shows, the rants that I've gone on, really? When I do that, do I have it in my head, oh, I'm going to one day work for WWE? Really? Do you not listen to this show? I know Corey doesn't. But just, I'm talking in general. Like, come on. Boy, if I want to work for WWE, given some of the things I've said on this show, I'm doing a pretty piss-poor job of it. I'm putting a pretty piss-poor resume together for this fantasy position that doesn't exist. But it is nice of Corey to make assumptions about my career goals. I appreciate that. Now, he replied later on to somebody else. He said, I don't know Solomonster, like, personally. I don't know Solomonster, aside from him making fun of me. And then in parentheses, he says, and sometimes rightfully so. At least he's self-aware. I'll give him that. At least he acknowledges that he deserves it sometimes. So I will leave you with this. Corey has his own show. He has his own show for WWE that he does. Let the man do his own thing. I have no issue with Corey Graves outside of the dumb comments that he makes sometimes. And when he does, I call him out for it, like I would anybody else. He is no different than anybody else. And this was another one of those times. Monday Night Raw was in Hartford, Connecticut last Monday, the final show of 2019. A show that was so polarizing that I felt the need to record a early Raw review and get it up on the YouTube channel the very next day, which is always very interesting when I decide to do that. Now, there were some things on the show that I enjoyed, but there were also things that I did not enjoy. And so what I'm going to do for you now, because a lot of people may not have heard the review, if you're not on the YouTube channel or subscribed, if you're not, shame on you. Or if you just don't do the YouTube thing, you might not know. I am going to include my Raw review here and now. If you've already heard it, you want to skip ahead, goes about 25 minutes or so. But if not, here is my full review, my full thoughts on Monday Night Raw and the wedding of Lana and Bob Lashley from last Monday night. And the big reveal, the big twist at the end. And if it sounds like a familiar storyline pitch to you, there's a reason for that. What the hell did I just watch? This is your Sound Off Extra review for the final Monday Night Raw of 2019 from the XL Center in Hartford, Connecticut, the scene of the crime, the final Monday Night Raw of the decade, and a show that gave 2018 Monday Night Raw a run for its money as the worst show on television, talking about 2019 Raw in general. This was the night of the big Bobby Lashley, Lana wedding. Wedding bells were ringing. So are my ears. Wrestling weddings usually are good for ratings, so it would not surprise me if Raw is up this week because of this segment. And I was hopeful that a wedding angle meant the end of this dumb storyline in some way, whatever the payoff was. But it appears that it is going to continue well into the new year. And we all have Vince McMahon and Paul Heyman to thank for that. Oh yes, don't think I forgot about Paul Heyman in all of this, because that last segment had ECW written all over it, and not in a good way. I am sick as a dog. If I sound like it, that's why I sound that way. I just got over a head cold from hell about a week ago. And then I was around a bunch of little kids over Christmas who all had colds. I didn't stand a chance. Yeah, it's like if one person has a cold, it's like, all right, I'll stay away from that child. I'll stay away from that person. When four of them have colds, you're pretty much a dead duck. I thought you weren't supposed to be able to get sick again so soon after being sick. I guess that was a myth. I wish this show is a myth and that it wasn't real, but it was. Oh, it was very real. First, I'm going to get to the good parts that I liked, because there were some good things on this show. I'm not going to come on here and sound like a sourpuss, and everything was terrible, everything was horrible, it was the worst Raw of the year. It wasn't. There were some good things on this show. Kevin Owens opened the show. He's charging after Seth Rollins and AOP. He gets overwhelmed in the ring until angry Samoa Joe makes the babyface save. I thought that was good stuff. It's good to see Joe back in action. Although commentary now suffers for it. But I was glad to see him back in action here. He got Rollins in the coquina clutch. AOP broke it up. Owens grabbed a chair. Security broke things up. Owens wiped out everybody with a senton out to the floor. Backstage, Owens told Joe, you know, we've known each other for a long time. And he's known a lot of bad people. Some of whom booked this show. But none as bad as Joe. And he meant that as a compliment. And security tried to escort them out, and Joe had a great line in here. He said, if anybody touched him, they wouldn't be able to feel with their fingers anymore. I said last week I'd be down for a Joe and Owens alliance against Seth and AOP, and now we're getting it, and I think that's great. We had the rematch from TLC between Aleister Black and Buddy Murphy. It was exactly as advertised, a very good match. Similar to their pay-per-view match, Black beat him with not one, but two Black Mask kicks. Aleister Black has been protected more than most since coming to the main roster. I believe he's unbeaten since coming to Raw a few months ago. I'm not talking about that run with Ricochet earlier in the year. I'm talking about since he's been looking for somebody to pick a fight with him. And he's been sitting in a closet for a few months and then finally started wrestling. I believe he's been undefeated. Now, they could have had Murphy roll him up, you know, WWE style, go 50-50 with things, and they didn't. You know, he beat Murphy at the pay-per-view. He came here on Raw, and he beat Murphy again. They've made it very clear who the better man is in this feud. They have gone in strong on Aleister Black, as they should, because he's going to be a top player for them in 2020. Charlotte comes out. She cuts an awful, rambling promo, entering herself into the Women's Royal Rumble match. Took her 10 minutes to say what she could have said in two. And then she says, I got my boots on, I'll wrestle anybody in the back. And then Natalya's music hit, and I groaned. And then my hacking cough kicked in. But then they went and they had a pretty good match. And Charlotte tapped her out in the figure eight. You know, the thing about these two have pretty good chemistry together. It goes all the way back to their NXT Women's Championship match in 2014 when Charlotte beat Natty to win the title. This was after Paige was stripped because she had gone to the main roster and she won the Divas title. And I think JBL was the general manager at the time. And so he stripped her of the title and they had a tournament. And Charlotte beat Natty for it in the finals. And that was an excellent match. So going all the way back 5 years, they've had good chemistry together. The problem is, I just cannot bring myself to care about anything that Natty does. From the moment her music hits to the time that she walks to the back, I just don't care. And I don't know if part of it is just that she's been there so long. She's faced everybody there is to face. I mean, what is there to be excited about? Nothing. Plus, they sent the Geek Squad out in the middle of the match to chase R-Truth around the ring for the 24/7 title, just so Charlotte could give Eric Young a boot to the face. Eric Young, who I keep forgetting, even has a job in this company, and I don't even know why he does. But she boots him in the face. You know, I gave praise on my show on Sunday. I said I liked what they did with R-Truth and Tozawa in New York City last week when they went on location and they filmed some funny stuff with the 24/7. Because I'm over the 24/7 title. I have been over this title for months. It is played out. It has jumped 15 sharks. I enjoyed what they did last week. I thought it was cute. I thought it was kind of funny. I like it when they leave the building and they go on location sometimes like that. This week, it was right back to the same lame bullshit where they run in circles and they chase him into the crowd just so they can transition into a commercial break. Uncreative, unimaginative bullshit that, you know what, I suppose fits in well on a show that ended the way that this one did. Becky Lynch against Asuka is official for the Raw Women's Championship at the Royal Rumble, which they didn't really do much this week. I mean, they had Becky there to announce the match and make it official. There was nothing new with her and Asuka. We knew this match was going to happen anyway. I'm glad it's happening. It was ridiculous the way that they just completely forgot that Asuka not only beat Becky at the Rumble last year, but tapped her out. Should have been her first feud coming out of WrestleMania. Realistically, I mean, I understand that Asuka probably would have lost. And in hindsight now, they get a big Royal Rumble rematch out of it. But there's no way they had that planned. Supposedly, Heyman is the one who wanted to go back. And I'll give Heyman credit for that. If it was his, if he's the one responsible for coming back around to this feud, good on him. Because it was ridiculous that Asuka wouldn't go on TV and speak up and say, hey, the woman who went to WrestleMania and won the championship, guess what? Becky Two Belts, guess what? I beat her at the Royal Rumble. I should be next in line for a title shot. So at least we're getting it now. Randy Orton. Randy Orton was injured at a live event on Sunday night in Hershey, Pennsylvania, while he was wrestling AJ Styles. He went down with a leg injury. They stopped the match. So on Raw, Orton walked out on crutches. He had to be helped into the ring for a promo where he was acting like he may have to retire. This is such a gruesome leg injury that he may have to call it quits. Up to that point, they had me fooled. I thought it might be a legitimate injury. Now, I wasn't following along with all the news reports during the day. In fact, I didn't read anything. Outside of the injury report on Sunday night, I did not read anything about the Orton stuff during the day on Monday. So maybe there was something said that, you know, led most people to know, oh, it's all a work, it's all an angle. All I had to go on was the fact that, hey, there's some fan cam footage online that Orton got hurt and they had to stop the match. And usually when they have to stop the match and you don't give the people what they paid for, you know, that's not usually something that is shot as an angle. So they had me fooled up until the point that Orton said I might have to retire. Once he said that, I knew. That gave it away. But I will give Orton credit here. He was rambling like he didn't know what to say. He was all dejected. And then he admitted, he said, look, I'm rambling, guys. Here's what happened. And he talked about, he felt a pop in his knee and everything else. He said he's going to be gone a long time. He said he's seen champions have to stand in this ring and surrender their titles due to injury. Hell, one of the few men he respects, Edge, had to give up his whole freaking career. And I thought that was an interesting little name drop there. Edge was the only name he singled out, by the way. It was interesting. He promised to do what he could to make sure that somebody got RKO'd at WrestleMania. That brought out AJ Styles, who mocked him. He said that he would wait until WrestleMania, put him in the calf crusher, and retire him for good. And then he kicked one of Orton's crutches out from underneath him, and he's damn lucky that that thing didn't go flying into the crowd, because it was a good kick, too. The only thing that saved that thing from going into the crowd were the ropes. I thought that thing was going flying. So he kicked the crutch out from underneath Orton's arm. Orton said, you know, there's one difference between you and I. You're a patient man. And he said, me? I'm not. And then he gave AJ an RKO, and he revealed that, in fact, there is no leg injury. His leg is just fine. I will say, that's an awful lot of trouble to go through just to deliver an RKO to a man that he was already in the middle of a match with the night before when he faked the injury in the first place. He could have given him an RKO then. But he chose to walk around all day with crutches and hope, put in kayfabe mode here, and hope that AJ would just walk out to confront him. Only for him to surprise him with an RKO. That's a lot of effort to put into something so ridiculous. I like the segment. I actually like the little swerve they did here, but I'm just saying it didn't make a whole lot of sense. Andrade pinned Ricochet. after Zelina Vega pushed Ricochet off the top rope. The match was fine. The real story here is what Zelina was wearing. Oh my goodness. I hope she wears that every week. The hell with the match. They should have just had a camera positioned outside the ring for the entire match, just aimed at her. Good lord. So see, I did enjoy some things on this show. Probably Zelina being the most important. So it wasn't like the worst Raw of all time that we got last November. Okay, and I still say to this day, that's not hyperbole. You want to hear about the worst Monday Night Raw of all time? You can find the video review on this YouTube channel from November of last year. Was it November 26th? I think that date still sticks in my head. This was not as bad as that show. That was a show that was an embarrassment far beyond anything I had ever seen before. But this last segment was the worst all year. Not only was it bad, you know, we've gotten some bad segments, but it never ended. Like, if you have a bad 5 or 10 minute segment, it's 5 or 10 minutes. This segment went on forever. Now, I fell asleep last night. I only watched it this morning. I did go back and I watched everything I missed. I fell asleep in the middle of the show. So I went back and I wake up this morning and I didn't see any spoilers about how the segment ended. I just saw the number one trend. I don't know if this was nationally. I don't know if this was just in New York. But the number one trend on Twitter, or one of them, was Katie Vick. As soon as I saw that, I said, oh no. And I will say before I even get into this segment, as somebody who lived through Katie Vick, and I'm sure many of you did as well, and there were probably an equal number of people listening to this right now who either weren't watching wrestling at the time, or are too young to remember that segment. It was 2002. I mean, we're talking almost 20 years, so it was a long time ago. But as somebody who lived through Katie Vick and remembers it well, let's not get carried away here. This was not as bad as Katie Vick. Katie Vick was something that played out over the course of a few weeks. You had the initial reveal. You had the segment with Triple H in the ring with the mannequin. You had, of course, the infamous funeral parlor segment with the casket. I will not regale you in what happened there. So let's not get too carried away here. But the fact that Katie Vick was trending, and I did have one person tweet me saying that it wasn't in relation to the show. There was some kind of podcast interview with someone about Katie Vick. I don't buy that. Every tweet I'm looking at that had Katie Vick in it had to do with this fucking show. When you see Katie Vick trending on Twitter, that's a bad sign. So I already knew going into this that this was going to be a dandy of a segment. And I didn't know. I had people tell me the show ended at 11:10 p.m. Usually they have a hard stop now at 11. They don't let them go overtime anymore. So if that's true, that means they had to get advance permission from USA Network to run 10 minutes overtime for this steaming pile of rhinoceros shit. They had to get special permission for this. Think about that. Now, I understand that some people like segments like this. These are probably the same people that enjoy watching car crashes on the highway, that enjoy watching reruns of Jerry Springer and Maury Povich. I'm a Steve Wilkos guy myself on those rare occasions when I do watch shows like that. That guy doesn't take any shit. But when I'm done watching it, on those rare occasions when I do tune in to Steve Wilkos, I feel like I have to take a shower. I sometimes watch this channel. It's called Nosy or Nosy TV. It's on the Pluto TV app on my phone. Channel 158, FYI, if you're interested. It's all free. Because somebody told me it has old reruns. That channel has old reruns of Blind Date, back when Roger Lodge used to host the show. And that was always, that show was a guilty pleasure of mine. So I would tune into Channel 158 here on Pluto from time to time, and I'd have to, but they'd have Jerry Springer, and they'd have Maury, and they'd have all this other garbage on before I could even get to Blind Date. So anyway, that's why I am reminded of shows like that. Some people like that. And that's okay. You do you. When WWE tries to copy that stuff, it is almost always pure cringe. Like the Bella Twins segment with Jerry Springer. I wish this segment had died in the womb. Segment starts. We have fucking Bill Belichick in the ring for some reason officiating this ceremony. He did as good of a job keeping things in order here as he did in that loss to the Dolphins on Sunday. They had empty chairs on stage because nobody accepted their wedding invitations. Apparently, Lana has no family. Lashley has no family. Nobody else likes them. You know what I enjoyed? A little sidebar here. And no, it was not this segment. But when I think about segments like this that WWE has done, and there have been a ton of weddings, and some are hit and some are miss. But you know what I enjoyed? I enjoyed when Teddy Long got married to Crystal Marshall on SmackDown. That was funny. That, I felt, was a well-done segment. Had the Godfather come out to remind Teddy of all the good times they had. They forced all the roster members to attend, so all the wrestlers were lined up in chairs in the aisleway. CM Punk is out there in a suit. Vince McMahon was sitting in the front row trying to get Hornswoggle to behave. He kept fucking around with Coachman. I remember laughing at that. I think they even had, what was her name, Brooke Tessmacher. From TNA, before her TNA days. I think she was there as one of the maids of honor. I remember seeing her in there. Fucking IRS and Sergeant Slaughter were out there as guests. Patterson and Briscoe. They can be entertaining with these things when they want to be. The Billy and Chuck wedding angle, which was really well done. And served a purpose, at least. That was actually a major angle that they shot. That's one of the best angles they ever did on SmackDown. This right here was not one of those times. Lashley's out there. He's wearing a sleeveless tuxedo. Lana comes out. They cut to commercial. They cut to commercial. Here in the middle of this wedding. They come back. Lana's yelling. Lana is yelling some more. She demands that Bill Belichick read from the script that she provided to him. She said the greatest gift that Lashley could ever give himself was her. She jumped on Lashley. The two of them started making out. Her makeup was all... I don't know what was going on. Her makeup was all messed up now. It was all smudged. She looked like she had some horrible facial tan. Lashley told her to wipe her teeth. This was a mess. She said it took her a long time to write Lashley's vowels for him. That's what she called them. She thinks she's Vanna White, apparently. Lashley proceeded to botch his own vowels. The acting here. Holy shit. I've seen better acting in porn than we saw here. They exchange rings. Bill Belichick said, if there's anyone who sees any reason, these two should not be married. Speak now or forever hold your peace. And out walked Tom Brady. No. Out walked a random independent wrestler claiming to be Lana's first husband. And she left him for that son of a bitch, Rusev. And then she left that son of a bitch for this son of a bitch. And so Lashley chokeslammed him. So then out next was Carissa Rivera. See, I'm old enough to remember when she and Chris Statlander wrestled as the Brooklyn Bells against the Iconics on an episode of SmackDown earlier this year. I remember that because I'm a Brooklyn boy, so I remember the Brooklyn Bells. But tonight, she was Bobby Lashley's first wife. And this is the part of the segment where it gets so... Some people will say, oh, it's meant to be goofy. It's meant to be... This is the part of the segment where they trot these people out. And it's just... Oh, God. I couldn't stand this. This was just... Oh. Oh! She says they met while he was in the military. He probably wished he was back on the battlefield, I would say, last night. He'd have an easier time dodging enemy fire than he would getting through this segment. Lana slapped her. And that was the end of her. And then out came Liv Morgan. The same Liv Morgan, who I've been asking for months, where's Liv Morgan? They were doing a character change with her, and we haven't seen her since July. Where's Liv Morgan? And then suddenly we start seeing these vignettes on television promoting the return of Liv Morgan. She's been taking a bubble bath for the last 4 weeks. I'm surprised her skin wasn't all pruned up when she walked out here. She's been taking a bath. The last few weeks. Well, this was her grand return. She finally came back, and this was their idea for her. And she's teasing, no, you know, I can't allow this to happen. And she's teasing that the love of her life is in the ring. And then we find out it's not Lashley. It's Lana. Lana was nearly in tears as Liv was asking her, you're not in love with him. What are you doing here? And then finally... Lana attacked Liv, and the two of them rolled around on the mat like it was ECW in 1996. The only thing missing was Joey Styles screaming catfight on commentary. Hot lesbian action has returned to Monday Night Raw. Now, if this scenario sounds familiar to you, it's because I just pitched this idea on Sunday's podcast, but not for this. This was not what I had in mind when I pitched the idea on Sunday. I pitched it as an eventual payoff to an Otis-Mandy Rose wedding with Sonya Deville in the role that Liv Morgan had here. See, the difference is that that's a story that has already been teased before on WWE television and would actually make storyline sense if Sonya Deville was to come out and stop some kind of union, as rare as it would be for to even think of Mandy Rose marrying Otis, but just bear with me here. But the idea would be that Sonya can't allow this to happen, not because she's interested in Otis, but because she's got a thing for Mandy, and she can hide her feelings no more. They took that idea, not from me, I'm sure, but they took that idea, and instead, they used it here, for this shitty angle. Way to go, you schmucks. Can't use it now. This was done for, as opposed to what I just pitched, at least, where I tried to make some sense of it. It ties into an ongoing story on SmackDown. This was just done for shock value. Plain and simple. That's all they did this for, just for shock value. And it makes me wonder if this was even their original plan for Liv Morgan's return, or if somewhere along the way, Paul Heyman said, hey, I've got a great idea to swerve everybody. This show swerved right off the edge of a cliff with this segment. Lana tried to resume the ceremony after Liv got carried off when all of a sudden Rusev pops up out of the cake and he attacks Lashley. And then Liv comes back and she threw Lana into the cake to end the show and end this decade in disgrace. Think about this. They began the decade in WWE with Bret Hart returning after 12 years away, confronting Shawn Michaels in the middle of the ring. And they end the decade with a segment that would probably drive Bret away for another 12 years. And I don't think anybody would blame him. Here's my other question. Why would Rusev even care? Why would he be upset? Didn't he get his divorce from Lana already? What, didn't he actually get the divorce during the segment? Was he not out there last week celebrating his new bachelor life? He seemed to be the happiest guy in the world to be away from this woman. That's Bobby's problem now. I mean, why would he care? Why would he care enough to hide inside this cake and subject himself to 20 minutes of this shit? What must he have been thinking, standing in that cake? Just to pop out and beat up Lashley some more? It's like, the best revenge he could get is to let him marry her. Let the wedding go through. Is that not punishment enough? Next Monday, Brock Lesnar is back, although he may be having second thoughts after watching this segment. As if he watches this show, give me a break. Rey Mysterio gets a rematch for the United States title against Andrade, and the Viking Raiders will defend the Raw Tag Team titles against Gallows and Anderson and the Street Profits. And I would sit here and tell you that it's a chance for a fresh start with a new year, a new decade. But I said the same thing last year, after the worst year in Monday Night Raw history, and they followed that up with probably the second worst year in Monday Night Raw history. SmackDown on Fox Friday night was from Memphis, Tennessee. Remember the old Andy Kaufman days where he would try to make fun of Jerry Lawler and the people of Memphis? I'm going to come down to Memphis, Tennessee. Can you imagine if he did that now? The blowback he would probably get. He would invite the heavyset women and he would wrestle them and he would beat them up and insult them. It's just incredible the things that were, I say acceptable. I'm sure it riled a lot of people up even back then in the early 80s. But, you saw stuff like that today. Forget about it. He'd be exiled. From comedy, he'd be exiled from everything, Andy Kaufman would be. Twitter poll, over 2,300 votes. Unless the pendulum has swung back in the other direction. I checked it last night. And almost a split decision. It was 50-50 up until last night. And the total last I checked was 49% thumbs up, 51% thumbs down. So a very razor-thin majority thumbs down, which is, I think, actually an improvement for what SmackDown has been doing in a lot of these polls. This was a show that was highlighted by the returns of Sheamus, who they've been teasing now with these vignettes for weeks, John Morrison, who has not been in the company since, I believe, the end of 2011, and the Usos, who have not been seen since Jimmy had his last little traffic infraction. And so we have all of these returns now on the SmackDown roster, which now add depth to a roster that I think really needed some more depth to it. So in that respect, it's a good thing to get these bodies back on TV. And also we saw what appears to be, and we'll see how it plays out on TV this week, but what appears to be a heel turn, a change in character for The Miz. I talked about the show with Wade Keller on his podcast after SmackDown on Friday. One of the other individuals who was kindly wrapped up in that whole Twitter chain with Corey Graves earlier this week was Wade. But we talked about the women's match that opened the show. It was Lacey Evans and Dana Brooke against Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross against Sasha Banks and Bayley, three-way match. Dana Brooke. Now, it's not a surprise that Lacey Evans' team won, because Lacey Evans is the one who's being pushed to a championship match, I'm guessing, at the Royal Rumble with Bayley. But Dana Brooke is the one who not only got the pin, but she pinned Sasha Banks. Now, Sasha did take Lacey's finishing move, and then she took this this dive off the top rope by Dana Brooke, this senton. And so, you know, it wasn't as though she just kind of slapped her in the face and just pinned her clean in the middle. But Dana Brooke hits this senton off the top, and she absolutely crushes Sasha Banks with this thing. She landed up. Be surprised if Sasha doesn't have at least sore ribs, if not cracked ribs, after that landing. And it looked, I could be wrong, but it looked and sounded like she apologized to Sasha before she went for the pin. She landed full force on top of this woman. And Sasha's not a big girl. You know, she's kind of thin. She's kind of a, you know, she's not like Alexa Bliss tiny, but she's, you know, she's a small girl. And Dana just absolutely wrecked her on that landing. And I look at it and I go, look, they're clearly doing something with Dana Brooke. And what I mean doing something, I don't know if that means they have a long-term story for her. I don't know if she's going to get a championship match months from now. This could be one of those little start and stop things where they give somebody a few wins and they start to build a little tiny bit of momentum, and then Vince McMahon gets bored. And then all of a sudden we don't see them on TV anymore. You know, Dana is one of these people who, I know she's worked hard to improve, and I've enjoyed the banter with her and Big Dave Batista on Twitter and everything. And I'd like to see the two of them in some kind of like a skit or some kind of like dating. You know what I'd like to see, now that I think about this? You guys know my fondness of the old Blind Date TV show. I've talked about this recently. It's a guilty pleasure of mine. I would like to see that. Now, the problem is that when WWE tries this, when they try to copy other things, like their comedy, they did this with the Street Profits a few weeks ago on Raw. They did an SNL weekend update type segment. I couldn't believe these people who were like, oh, I'm knee slapping. I thought it was so funny. I thought it was cringe. I don't know what these people were watching or what their idea of comedy is. But anyway, when they try stuff like that, more often than not with the comedy shit, it's hit. Or it's miss. It's a miss rather than a hit. So maybe this isn't such a great idea. But imagine if you had Batista and Dana Brooke in the old format of the old Blind Date show. I don't know if they still do this on the new reboot that they have that I haven't watched. I would laugh my ass off with the thought bubble pop-ups. That was the real humor of the show. It wasn't just these train wreck dates that they would sometimes have that you just, you know, it's like so bad you can't turn away from. But they would have these pop-ups as they're talking on the screen. Think of the old like VH1 pop-up video stuff. And whoever was writing the comedy and the jokes on this show, it was hilarious. like I would bust a gut sometimes laughing at some of the jokes. If they could find somebody as funny and talented as the people who used to write the jokes for that old Blind Date show, I'd love to see Batista and Dana Brooke out going on a date. They go to a restaurant. Maybe they go to an amusement park. They do this. They do that. And the whole time we have these pop-up messages throughout their date. Just put the whole thing on YouTube. Can make it like a YouTube segment. Again, I just have no faith in the humor that WWE would probably put together for something like this. Maybe Dave can get one of his Hollywood buddies, you know, one of the script writers or something, to write the humor for a sketch like that. That's the most entertaining I have found Dana Brooke, is her back and forth with Batista. In the ring, there's a long way to go. But she's picked up some wins recently, so they're building to something. I don't know what. And if that's what they're trying to do, they're trying to get something going with her, then that's fine. I can't imagine Sasha Banks is going to be sticking around long-term in this company if this is the kind of thing they have her doing. Supposedly, you know, she re-signed some kind of deal with them last year. I don't think it was a long-term deal. I don't think they have her locked up for 5 years the way they do a lot of other people. So however long it is she's got, whether it's a year, 2 years, whatever it was, I would not be surprised still. Even though she re-signed, I would not be surprised to see Sasha Banks working somewhere else at some point, because to see her in there now losing to people like Dana Brooke is quite the come down from where she had been previously. But, you know, I guess when you really look back at Sasha and the way that the things that she's done and the matches that she's been involved in, I mean, she's had kind of a charmed career in that company, aside from all the short title reigns. She can't seem to win a championship and hold on to it for longer than 3.5 minutes. So maybe they're just, you know, using somebody who has credibility like her to help get somebody else over. I just don't know if Dana Brooke is the right person for that. We had a segment with Otis and Mandy, my favorite story right now on WWE television. Otis and Mandy, we saw what happened the week before where Otis presented her with a cake that was baked by his mother. And Dolph Ziggler in a later segment put the cake on the floor and stomped on it with his new Jordans or whatever brand of shoe it was. I'll text Shane McMahon. He seems to be the sneaker expert. And so Otis walked by in the hallway later on. He saw the cake. He was devastated by this. So Mandy comes up to Otis, who's preparing for his match with, I think it was Drew Gulak. And, hey, you know, Otis, how you doing? Did your mom bake anything else for me? And Otis is just, you could see, he's clearly heartbroken. This man's feelings have been hurt. He says, why don't you ask Dolph Ziggler? And then he had a match, you know, Tucker comes over and kind of stares a hole at Mandy, and Mandy's standing there and she's all dejected and she feels bad about what happened. And so there really wasn't too much advancement in the story this week. It's just one of those little segments they were sure to stick in there. And later on, Otis, you know, beat up Drew Gulak and beat him with a Vader bomb in his match. So Otis is getting a little bit of a push out of this. Now, I don't want to see him be pushed right out of that tag team, because I think that would be probably not a good thing for him or Tucker. I wouldn't break them up, but the fact that they're shining more of a light on Otis, who I find very entertaining, is a great thing, I think. And it's a little bit more in the way of advancement of the story. I thought maybe they would do Ziggler and Otis in a match. I guess they could still do that down the road. But that was the extent of the Otis and Mandy stuff on the show this week. There was a segment backstage where Big E was with Kofi, and The Miz was back there, and Big E said that he watched the balls drop. I don't know what I'm saying anymore. He watched the balls drop on New Year's. And Kofi pointed out, there's only one ball. He goes, what the hell were you watching? We could all imagine what Big E must have been watching. I don't want to know. There was a segment backstage with The Revival. They were making short jokes about Chad Gable. Gable's new catchphrase that I hope dies in a fire is rise over size. If this were 20 years ago, we would have a very different backstage segment with Val Venus making fun of Chad Gable for a very different reason. And he would still be the butt of the jokes. Rise over size is his new catchphrase. I certainly put that on a t-shirt. We'll see how many they sell. I'm going to say they don't sell very many. You know, I'm old enough to remember when Chad Gable kind of got over during that King of the Ring tournament. Remember that great King of the Ring tournament? It was so long ago. It was, you know, what was this, 7 months ago? It feels like a lifetime ago. It feels like an eternity. He was actually getting over, doing what he does best, through his work in the ring. He was getting over. And then they said, well, he's getting over. So we have to stop this. I know what we'll do. We'll call him Shorty G. And we'll dress him up like something out of fucking Space Jam. Boy, that's done his career a world of wonders, hasn't it? Look at the reactions that he gets now when he comes out on television every single week. Look at the way that this guy looks. Boy, he's so much more over now than he was before, right? Nope. He's less over. So whatever they had with him, I don't know how far they would have gone with it. He might be in the same spot now that he's in, had they just kept him going out there as, the great wrestler, the great underdog babyface Chad Gable. They never gave him a chance. The minute they gave him that shitty name with that shitty gear, that was it. It was over. You know it, and I know it. I talked about it at the time. I said, what are you doing? You're cutting this guy's legs off. And here we are, a few months later. Boy, look how over Chad Gable is. I said this on the show with Wade. I said, so what would you have done with him? I said, well, it's very simple. I think what could have worked for him, and he could have remained a solid player in that middle of the card, at least for a while on SmackDown. He really didn't have to be anything more than the guy who went in there and wowed you with strong spots that you wouldn't expect someone like him would be able to do. Because I've seen him throw guys around with that Chaos Theory and other moves. Guys that were twice his size. And it always gets a pop out of the audience. So yeah, you can have a segment like this, maybe where he's backstage as Chad Gable and he's being bullied around by the heels. Look at you. You think you could take me? Hey, short stack, and throw some short jokes at him without turning this whole storyline into I'm so short, which he really fucking isn't. And that's the other thing that's just annoyed me this whole time. You would think this guy, when he walks out there, he cuts these speeches, I accept my flaws and I accept who I am. What are you, 3'8"? He's an average size guy. Was he 5'8"? That's average. In today's WWE, with all the smaller guys they have, he's average size. This is not the land of the giants anymore. You don't have a whole roster full of Braun Strowmans and Brock Lesnars. But they push this narrative. It's like, we have this agenda. We want to do a storyline for the kids. Let's use Chad Gable and let's say that he's been held back because he's too short. I've been short my whole life. Never seemed to be a problem for him before. All of a sudden, I've come to accept my problem. It's like it's some kind of fatal flaw in his DNA or something. All you needed to do was have this guy who is on the smaller side, and maybe he gets pushed around a little bit, and he looks at the other guy and he kind of laughs. He's like, all right, I'll see you out there. And they go out there, and he just blows people away by throwing these guys around like they're nothing. And out-wrestling them and making them look stupid. I would compare it to what they did with Hardcore Holly and Crash Holly back in the late 90s. Crash Holly was a smaller guy as well. Bob Holly was not what I would call a small person. But you had Kane and The Undertaker and The Big Show and a few other big guys back then. And he'd be in there with them, and he was the super heavyweight. They would announce him as 450 pounds. It was hilarious. He would come out because in storyline, he thought he was this giant of a man. He thought he was this giant killer, and he would go out there, and he was completely delusional. But in this case with Gable, he'd be able to back it up in the ring because I've seen him do it before. That's all you would need. I guarantee you he would get over with the crowds if you did that. Almost like this, silent killer in a way. He'll smile at you. He'll crack jokes. He'll show some personality in the back. But you push him around. You push this guy's buttons. Uh-oh. It ain't going to end well for you. But what they're doing with him now, it's frustrating. It's very frustrating. So they have the revival back there, and they're making short jokes, and he throws this stupid new catchphrase that I guarantee you will not even be a catchphrase a month from now. It'll be forgotten. And this was for a match that he would go out there and have with, I believe it was Dash Wilder. Now, at the end of this match, and I was more focused on what happened post-match. I believe it ended on a DQ when Dawson got involved, and he was being ganged up on. And out comes Sheamus. Sadly, we don't have his old theme music back. There were not too many limes or lobster heads here on this TV show. He is using his new... And his newer music is cool. I kind of would like to hear the old music. So he comes out white as a ghost. I mean, we know this, it's Sheamus, but my God, the way they put that spotlight on him, you would think that some portal to another dimension was opening up, but no, it's a human being. And he comes down to the ring, and it looks like he's coming to save Chad Gable. And the Revival, they take a powder, they bail, they get the hell out of there. And then Sheamus turns around, and he mows down Chad Gable with this awesome-looking brogue kick that Gable just sold like death. He got folded up like an accordion, this guy did. And nearly took his head clean off his shoulders with this brogue kick. And I'm looking at this, and I'm like, you know, between Daniel Bryan shaving his head and shaving his face, and Sheamus going back to his old haircut and his old look, it's like some portal opened up back to 2012 or something. I feel like we have just been transported back to the year 2012. Now, Sheamus and Gable, if this was going to be Sheamus's first program back, maybe it was just a one-night thing and Gable just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But if this was going to become a program, if there was going to be a match or a series of matches between the two of them, I know it's not going to end well for Chad Gable. Chad Gable is not going to beat Sheamus. I know this already. But I think it has the potential to be great. I think it has the potential to give us some great matches the way that Sheamus and Daniel Bryan did back in that year, back in 2012. Now, forget about their 18-second match at WrestleMania. You know, a lot of people may have forgotten that they followed that WrestleMania matchup the following month at Extreme Rules. That was the same show where Brock Lesnar had his first match back and he lost to John Cena in the main event, but I thought it was the match of the year. But on that same show was another contender for match of the year, an excellent 2 out of 3 falls match between Daniel Bryan and Sheamus. Gable and Bryan, they're similar in size, they're both great wrestlers. There's a lot of similarities between the two of them. I would love to see Gable and Sheamus get in the ring and be given 15 minutes to go out there, maybe on a pay-per-view, and have a match together. Now, I know he'll be bro-kicked into oblivion at the end, but I think that has the potential to be a really fun match. You know, some good chemistry, maybe, between the two of them. So we'll see if that's the direction they go in. Kofi Kingston pinned The Miz. The Miz he's been not himself ever since losing to The Fiend. He's been sort of obsessed, and he's just not happy about where his career is at this point. So after a little disagreement with the New Day backstage, we get this match. Kofi Kingston against The Miz. Miz loses the match. Kofi almost like a fluke, like roll-up pin on The Miz. Miz snaps. He attacks Kofi. He gets booed. And as he's backing up the ramp to go to the backstage area, he's looking out at the crowd. He can't believe that these people are booing him. After everything I've been through, he says. So it looks like Miz is a heel again, or going to be a heel again. Maybe he'll come out on TV and apologize this week. I was surprised that the fans took to him as a babyface the way that they did. And I said as much, you know, when he really started to get over as a babyface, during the alliance and everything with Shane McMahon, I was surprised, pleasantly surprised by that, because I did not think that people would get behind him the way that they did. He is a natural born heel. That is the role that he was born to play. Some guys are just better and more well-suited for that role. Some people are meant to be a babyface. Well, Pat Patterson once told Ricky Steamboat, Steamboat wanted to turn heel sometime in the early 90s. And Patterson's like, you are not a heel. People will never believe you are a heel. You're too nice of a guy. You're just a born and bred babyface. And they would not let this guy go heel. Some people are just natural in one role over the other. Some guys can play both roles equally well. Who knows? Maybe Ricky Steamboat would have been a badass heel. You know, he never got the chance to play one. Miz had the chance to play babyface, and he actually got over until, you know, the Shane McMahon feud and played itself out, and that pretty much killed whatever momentum as a babyface he had. He was never the same after that. He was never the same after that feud where Shane beat him at every turn. It was a feud designed to get Shane McMahon over, not get the Miz over. It actually made him a little less popular, I think, with the fans. So that was the beginning of the end for babyface Miz, I think, last year, after the stuff with Shane McMahon. But backstage, Kathy Kelly tries to get an interview with The Miz. She knocks on his door, and the door opens, but it's not The Miz. It's John Morrison, and maybe the most uneventful return that I have ever seen. Actually, I'll take that back. Maybe the second, you know what? Maybe it is the most uneventful. I was going to say Christian when he came back in 2009? Right? They brought him back on the ECW brand. I remember him walking out on ECW. And who was the announcer? Was it Matt Stryker? I don't remember who was doing the play-by-play at the time. It was like, or maybe it was, who's that guy? Maybe it was Grisham, but Todd Grisham. But Christian walks out, it's Christian. And he had been gone for years. He left the company like 4 or 5 years earlier, and he was, you know, NWA champion and TNA and all that. And so this should be kind of a big deal. It's like, it's Christian. That was it. That was it. All the excitement just sucked right out of the building right then and there. This might be worse. He opened a door. It's almost like he never left. He's been backstage the whole time. They just didn't knock on the right door. So there's John Morrison, and Morrison says Miz has nothing to say. He has no comment. And then he closes the door. So it looks like they may, in fact, be doing something with Miz and Morrison. I mean, obviously, they are doing something with Miz and Morrison. And when I first talked about this months ago, because remember, it was Mike Johnson of PW Insider, not WWE on their website, who broke the news back in September. WWE made the official announcement in December. PW Insider broke the story in September that John Morrison, he wasn't close to signing. He might sign. He signed. He was signed, sealed, and delivered with WWE in September. And I said at the time, the roster, the place that I think would be best suited to land him would be SmackDown. And if he goes to SmackDown, you can then do something with him and Miz. Let them rekindle their partnership. Let them start doing a few tag team matches together. Bring back the Dirt Sheet segment. Instead of Miz TV, you do the Dirt Sheet, and they do a few of those on TV. And eventually, you'll break them apart. They'll probably feud again. But why not? It would give Miz something to do, because there was no way he was beating Bray Wyatt for the championship. He never even got a title match. He had a non-title match, and he still lost. So the timing for The Miz is great, because now he can be a heel again, which he was born to play. He can, you know, he can do stuff with Morrison, and maybe this even, you know, leads into something at WrestleMania. For Miz, the timing could not be any better for Morrison to be back on TV. It's the right place for him to be. It's the right place for him to be. And Miz and Morrison maybe having some matches against The New Day? Hey, sign me up. I think those could be great matches. I think that would be great. Now, Corey Graves, they come back, they show the announcers at ringside, and Corey Graves makes a comment. We've heard rumblings of John Morrison possibly returning to WWE. Meanwhile, as I said, the company itself formally announced his return a month ago. And he appeared on one of their YouTube shows. He appeared on that Bump show with Kayla Braxton. And The Miz was on there. They piped him in there via Skype and everything, so this was hardly some kind of well-kept secret. But Graves has heard rumblings. This is what they had the man say. This is how stupid they made him look on TV on Friday night. That's quite the rumble. That's quite the rumble that he heard, given that the company announced this over a month ago. We had Braun Strowman over Cesaro in a match. Shinsuke Nakamura took out Strowman with a Kinshasa right at the bell. As soon as Strowman picked up the win and the referee counted three, Nakamura, who was out there for the match, hit Strowman with the Kinshasa. That is revenge for Strowman pinning Nakamura in a tag team match the week before. So they're setting up for an Intercontinental Championship match, maybe at the Rumble, between Strowman and Nakamura. And I said it before, if Braun Strowman can't win the Intercontinental Championship, then I don't know what's left for this guy to do. He can literally just be the Big Show of WWE, where they use him when they want to put him in there with a celebrity, if they want him to do comedy. We saw him dancing with the New Day a few weeks ago. Great. He can be a dancing fool. He could be a dancing fool on TV. He could be like the dancing New Year's baby that Big Show was a few years ago. He failed at every turn when it came to the WWE title or the Universal title. If he can't win the Intercontinental Championship, then just pack it up and go home. And the main event had Roman Reigns teaming with Daniel Bryan, taking on King Corbin and Dolph Ziggler. This is where we got the, first we got a Fiend appearance. Towards the end of the match, Bryan was in control, and the lights went out, and the Fiend appeared at ringside, and Bryan brawled with him for a little bit. He got the claw locked in, put Bryan down, so that was the end of Daniel Bryan. Roman Reigns was outgunned. He was outmanned. He was all by himself. And that's when the Usos made their return here on Friday Night SmackDown. So I don't know if this is the start of some new little faction. We've seen them align before, you know, many years ago. They had like this little bloodline type faction going on there. I think it's just a case where they'll be loosely aligned with Roman here a little bit. Maybe they'll have, some kind of six-man tag where they tag together. But I expect the Usos just to go back into the tag team ranks and probably be challenging for the title soon enough. It also means we may end up with more Usos and New Day matches. Now, Usos and New Day always have great matches together, but I mean, how many Usos and New Day matches are we going to get? I'm a little worried about that. Maybe we'll have the Usos against Morrison and Miz. Maybe that can be a tag team feud. But I think having them back in the tag team ranks is a strong addition to the SmackDown roster. I'm not quite sure how they would do it. I was thinking about this, and I actually got an email from somebody saying the same thing. But I just don't know how they would pull this off. How would they explain this on TV? Aside from maybe some kind of standoff in the ring at the Royal Rumble, but this seems like the perfect setup for Roman Reigns and the Usos in some kind of a match against Seth Rollins and the Authors of Pain. Everything's perfectly aligned. I just don't know how or why you would do that match. I just think the timing of it, though, you know, in terms of 3-on-3 would make sense. But pretty much in every other way, it would not make any sense. So I don't know if that's an idea they have. I don't know if maybe at the Rumble there'll be a little something going on there, or they won't have any interaction at all. So I thought SmackDown, I know a lot of people did not like the show. I think the Twitter poll says it all. I mean, it's almost a 50-50 split. I thought there was some good stuff, but I can't say when the show was over, I thought it was a terribly exciting show. I thought it was a decent episode of SmackDown, but the best part was getting some new faces back on TV. I think going forward, that's going to be a good thing, having new faces back on the show and starting up some new programs. So it's a positive sign, I think, going forward for the SmackDown brand. The first Dynamite of the new year for AEW did its best live audience on TNT since week 3 in October. 967,000 viewers to NXT's 548,000, but you can't compare the two because NXT was a best of highlight show this week, so you can throw that number out. I'll say that AEW wins this week, I think, but it probably is going to be down. If I had a guess, I'd say probably down about 120,000 or so viewers would be my prediction. You can check out my full Dynamite live stream from Wednesday night, the first Dynamite of 2020. Their homecoming special. It's up on YouTube, or you can check the audio out here on the feed, depending on how you are listening to this right now. The first audio I recorded for the new year. I thought it was a strong start for the year for AEW. Taz filled in for Tony Schiavone on commentary. I thought he did a great job working with JR and Excalibur. I'd like to see him fill in every time Schiavone has another commitment. Arn Anderson made his formal debut. We've seen him once before, but his formal debut on Dynamite, he appeared as Cody's head coach. Cody's head coach. That is his official role now on this TV show. If I were Cody, I'd have eyes in the back of my head. I wouldn't trust anybody. But to have somebody else turn on Cody so soon after he was already turned on by MJF, I would develop quite the distrust of other human beings if I was Cody. So I'm going to say that will not happen. I would not turn Arn or anything. I think it's a good role for him to be in right now. It's kind of this, almost like this football-type coach for Cody on television. Even though Cody has one of the better win-loss records of anybody on the entire roster, so it's kind of begs the question, why does he even need a head coach? Maybe he just likes Arn. But I could think of a lot of other people who probably could benefit from having a head coach on this TV show, not somebody who has the win-loss record that Cody does. We had Riho retaining her women's championship in what I thought was one of the better women's matches yet that I've seen in AEW, retained over Hikaru Shida, Britt Baker, and Nyla Rose, because Chris Statlander was already booked somewhere else, and so they've pushed her championship match back to Dynamite this Wednesday, and we will get the match that we were supposed to get last week with Riho defending her title against Statlander. I would not mind at all if they did a title change here. Yeah, like Riho, I don't hate Riho or anything, but I think it's time to get that title onto somebody else. I don't know if Statlander is now finished with her commitment. She may have to miss other shows. If that's the case, then maybe it's better to put it on somebody else. But Statlander, if she's done with all that and she's committed to Dynamite every Wednesday, then I think she would be a good choice to put that championship on. We had MJF announcing his stipulations on the show for the match with Cody. If Cody wants a match, it'll have to be at the Revolution pay-per-view on February 29th. And Cody has to first go through Wardlow inside of a steel cage before he could even think about getting to MJF. And then, I guess at some point before the pay-per-view, at some point before the match will be official, he has to allow, Cody does, has to allow MJF to whip him with a leather belt 10 times in front of his friends and family on TV. They have a Dynamite show coming up in Atlanta, I believe, next month, and so that might be the place where they do that. You know, the visual of having Cody's mom in the front row watching her son get whipped and lashed, and God only knows the things that MJF would say to Cody's mom. I can remember when Jerry Lawler used to make fun of Bret Hart's mother on television every week, and Bret Hart was getting hot. He did not like it. And Bret tells a story, and then one day his mother said, oh, you know, she thought that Lawler cracking jokes on her and Stu was the most hilarious thing she'd ever seen. And so then Bret loosened up a little bit. He said, okay, well, my mother actually enjoys it when you make fun of her, so it's all good. And then Lawler would come out, you know, Stu and Helen are old enough to remember when the Dead Sea was just sick, and it was a lot of corny one-liners, but it was back when Lawler was actually really funny. So maybe MJF will have some non-PG things to say about Cody's family and friends when they get to Atlanta. But anyway, those are his preconditions if Cody wants the match, which I'm sure is going to happen at Revolution. And they are teasing the Dark Order is a higher power that they answer to. And the question is, who is this higher power going to be? The choices that I floated on the live stream, my first thought was Marty Scurll. If he is coming in, that would be a good role for him. And then we can get some more insight into why they laid out the Elite all those weeks ago on that last Dynamite of the year. You know, it could be a simple story. It could be, you know, Marty thinking that his friends abandoned him. They left him behind. They all went and started this new venture together, and he was still stuck in purgatory where he was, and now he's extracting his revenge on all these guys who he thought were his friends. Or Hangman Page. You know, maybe there's an alliance between Marty Scurll and Hangman Page. Maybe they end up together. Who knows? But Hangman, they're definitely teasing some kind of turn or some kind of issue with him. So those are the key stories going on. Now, last week, they billed Dynamite as their homecoming edition since they were back at the Daly's place in Jacksonville, which I think Tony Khan owns. I think it's a very unique venue. Some people who don't usually watch AEW tuned in and said, oh, I didn't like it. It looked like some little tiny minor league operation running out of a smaller building. I guess if you've never watched the show before, then I could see where you might feel that way. I mean, they run regular buildings every week. Not the big, big ones like WWE runs, but they run big 7,000, 10,000 seat buildings every week. So I have absolutely no problem with them. I want to see them, in fact, do more of this. I used to love it when WCW would have Spring Break Nitro. You could have people watching that saying, what the hell is this? This is wrestling on live television and they're on the beach. Like, what is this stuff? Some people just, you know, they don't know how to have fun. These people must be really fun to hang out with at parties. I don't mind it. It's good to have some variety. Bigger venues, smaller venues. I don't see anything wrong with it. I want to see them do more of it. This week, they're promoting the show as the anniversary edition of Dynamite, the one-year anniversary, 1 year to the day of their Double or Nothing rally that they held in Las Vegas. And it will also double this week as a tribute to the Legends of Memphis Wrestling, where they will honor various legends throughout the night. The show is in South Haven, Mississippi, which is part of the greater Memphis area, or so says Wikipedia. Because my first thought was, they're in Mississippi. You know, why are they having a tribute to the Legends of Memphis Wrestling? And then I see that it's part of the greater Memphis area, so now it all makes sense. And apparently, the reason they're doing this is tickets have not been selling well. So this is being done as a way to drum up ticket sales, because they are not happy with how fast tickets are selling or not selling for this event. So this is a gimmick for them to try to drum up ticket sales. Lanny Poffo will be there to honor his brother Randy Savage and their father Angelo Poffo. Lance Russell will be honored. Dave Brown will be there. He'll also be a guest commentator on AEW Dark. since they have a revolving, rotating, you know, schedule of guest announcers every week. Doug Gilbert will be there to honor Eddie Gilbert and Tommy Gilbert. Brian Christopher will be honored. Austin Idol, Jimmy Valiant, and the Rock and Roll Express, I'm telling you, Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, they are getting more play in 2019, now here in 2020, than they have gotten in the last 30 years. It is incredible. Absolutely incredible. And it's almost entirely due to, I mean, Ricky Morton, let's be honest. I mean, Robert Gibson goes out there and he's smiling and he's putting the hand signal up and, you know, half the time he don't know where he is. I'm looking at Ricky Morton, and Ricky Morton, it's like this guy thinks it's 30 years ago. And he can still cut a hell of a promo, too. You just watch him on the NWA show every week. In fact, he was just on the NWA show again last week, each of the last 2 weeks. They're the tag team champions in the NWA. Unbelievable. Cody and Dustin Rhodes team up to take on the Lucha Bros. Riho will defend, as I mentioned, her women's title against Chris Statlander, assuming that she's available. She'll have to check her schedule first. Kenny Omega and Hangman Page, which nobody told the Hangman. He was kind of caught off guard when he found out on the show last week that, hey, you're going to be teaming up with Kenny Omega next week. Oh, great. Nobody told me. They're going to take on Private Party. Sammy Guevara takes on Christopher Daniels. And Jon Moxley will give Chris Jericho an answer as to whether or not he will join the Inner Circle after offering Moxley the role of executive vice president in the group. Boy, they give those EVP titles out like candy in this company, don't they? Plus, he's also offered Moxley 49% control of Inner Circle LLC and a new Ford GT worth millions, he said. Now, I looked it up online and I saw that it was listed for over $500,000. I have since been smartened up, that I was likely looking at the old model, and the new model is so rare that it does in fact cost $1 million, or upwards of $1 million. Driving a $1 million car in New York would give me far too much anxiety. I think driving a $1 million car anywhere would give me far too much anxiety. I don't think this is the kind of car people buy to drive around. That's just my sense. But Moxley and Renee, they live out in Vegas. They live out in the desert. A lot of wide open space out there. So maybe he'll find that appealing. NXT this week was a year in review award show. I don't care about their awards, but they did reveal the bracket for the 2020 Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, which consists of four teams from NXT and four teams from NXT UK. So we have Imperium, the team of Marcel Bartel and Fabian Aichner. They're going to be taking on the Forgotten Sons, Wesley Blake and Steve Cutler. That kicks off the tournament this Wednesday night. Also, Matt Riddle and Pete Dunne are going to be a tag team. They will be taking on Mark Andrews and Flash Morgan Webster. I don't know when, but that is the other half of the left side of the bracket. The right side of the bracket has the grizzled young veterans, Zach Gibson and James Drake, taking on Kushida and a mystery partner. And the first name that popped in my head, the man that he's been feuding with the last few weeks, Cameron Grimes. That's my prediction. That's my thought on that. And the other match is the Undisputed Era, Kyle O'Reilly and Bobby Fish, taking on, and they are the reigning NXT Tag Team Champions, taking on the reigning NXT UK Tag Team Champions, Gallus, team of Mark Coffey and Wolfgang. So that is what the brackets look like. So again, I see Cameron Grimes as a likely option as far as being Kushida's partner. So they go from rivals to rivals who respect each other as partners. My early pick to win is Matt Riddle and Pete Dunne. I'm going to go with Riddle and Dunne. I'm surprised they did not include Keith Lee and Lio Rush as a team, but that could be a sign they have bigger plans for Keith Lee. They don't want him involved, or if he's not going to win this tournament, they don't want him involved in losing in this tournament. So that could be a sign there. But I was very surprised when I saw the bracket released. I did not see Lio Rush and Keith Lee as a tag team. Speaking of Cameron Grimes, the main event for NXT this week is a fatal four-way to crown a new number one contender for the North American Championship with Grimes, Keith Lee, Dominik Dijakovic, and Damian Priest. And so I'm thinking it may be Keith Lee, and they end up going with Tommaso Ciampa as the one challenging Adam Cole next for the NXT Championship, maybe at the next TakeOver show. NWA Power, Episode 3. We had a great video to open up the show recapping the Nick Aldis-Tim Storm storyline. They have a TV title tournament match tonight here on the show that I am, not literally tonight, but on this show that I'm recapping here. So Storm's out there with Dave Marquez in the studio doing an interview. He's wearing a Mama Storm t-shirt. He has a Mama Storm t-shirt made. Now, it's not as nice as my Mama Monster t-shirt, but it's still nice. It's still a nice shirt. He apologized to Mama Storm before saying that he was going to kick Nick Aldis' ass. He's a mama's boy. Nothing wrong with that. Aldis walked out. He's flanked by Camille. Nothing wrong with that either. And he said that he only entered the TV title tournament for fun, because there was no one left for him to beat. He said guys like Storm and Ricky Morton, they joined the rest of the Randy the Rams in the back, which I thought was a great line, as a bunch of old guys who just can't quit hanging on. You know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see Camille and Yujiro's bunny girl, his his escort, his valet in New Japan. I'd like to see them in the same place at the same time. I believe that Yujiro's girl, I looked her up, I believe Yujiro's lady that he brings out to the ring with him is, I don't know if she's like not a dance instructor. I don't think it's yoga, but it's some kind of like yoga type thing. I think that she teaches over there in Japan. I was watching some of the videos just for research purposes. So anyway, they are quite lovely. Aaron Stevens, he won a special non-title submission exhibition over Sal Renaro. You could tell I need to get out more. Over Sal Renaro, when he would not let go of the Mongrovian clutch, Trevor Murdoch came out to make the save. He was very upset by Stevens taking advantage of these young guys. Sal Renaro is 37 years old, by the way, which, for personal reasons, I would like to think is really not that old. But let's be honest, in terms of wrestling, he's 37 years old. He's the same age as Aaron Stevens. So I thought that was kind of funny. He said he wanted to fight Stevens, which Stevens accepted, provided that Murdoch put up his spot in the TV title tournament. And it wasn't much of a match, but Murdoch won with an Indian deathlock to keep his spot. And the people liked Murdoch, so this was fine. He really is. I mean, just take one look at the guy. He really is just the perfect fit for this product. Like, you could look at some guys and say, man, this guy should be in WWE. This guy should be in AEW. This guy should go to New Japan. They should do this. They should do that. This guy just looks like he was put together in a machine and created for the purposes of being on this television show. Like, he just fits in perfectly. Stone Cold Eli Drake came out. He joked about being lost on the sauce last week, to say the least. And yet again, he says, I don't have a match. He accused Nick Aldis of trying to hold him down. Colt Cabana showed up and said that he... And I did see the clip. Somebody sent me this clip. I'm sorry I even watched it. I don't know where, if this just happened the other night or if this was from months ago. I have no idea. It was some 10-second clip or 7-second clip from an independent show where Joey Ryan was in the ring. I don't know if they were partners or if they just happened to be in the same match or what was going on here. I think maybe it was before the match. There's Joey Ryan, and there's Colt Cabana, and Colt Cabana goes over to Joey Ryan. He gets down on his knees, and he kisses Joey Ryan's dick. Right on the crotch. Just plants a wet one right on his crotch. I guess some people might enjoy that. I just don't understand it. I guess I'm just one of those people that doesn't get it. To me, that's... just whatever. I'm not going to say any more on that. So Colt Cabana showed up. He was sick of Eli Drake putting down his good friend Ken Anderson. He also reminds Drake that he's never won the NWA title, while he has won it twice. I have no memory of this. Tasha Steelz beat Marty Bell with an ugly looking cutter. Ugly in that Marty just fell too late and it looked bad. Melina got into the ring after. She was yelling at Marty. They've only been together a few weeks, maybe a month, and there's already trouble brewing. We've seen it now for a few weeks. They announced two new shows, two new NWA programs. One is a long-form discussion-based show called Power Surge. That's coming soon. The other is called Girl Power. And they aired the first one on this show. In one scene, it was Marty Bell, Melina, and Thunder Rosa sitting in the empty NWA studio, with Marty talking openly about her failed friendship with Allison Kay, and so they're keeping kayfabe here. The other scene had Allison Kay, Ashley Vox, Tasha Steelz, and ODB sitting around with Allison looking for advice about what to do. You know, me and Marty, we were friends for over 10 years, and I know I can be abrasive, but I'm very direct, and I speak the truth, and I speak my mind, and blah, blah, blah. And now it's all falling apart. It's basically girl talk, and I am not the audience for this. But if you are, there it is. Next week, in the TV title tournament, it is Zicky Dice against Caleb Conley. Shout out to Terrence for sharing a video with me from Funaki's favorite website, Indeed.com. Yes, I'm talking about the employment website. They posted a video feature on their YouTube channel about Zicky Dice. They did a feature on him working as a professional wrestler and also as a mental health technician for adults with disabilities, which is what he does by day. It's a job that he saw on the Indeed website, and I guess years ago, and he jumped at it. He said his father was a social worker, his mother worked as a nurse and a health educator, so he knew that he wanted to help people. And he said that he sees himself as a full-time caregiver inside and outside the ring, because, you know, inside the ring, you got to take care of your opponents. Outside the ring, he works with these other individuals. It's a great four-minute video that really sheds light on who this guy is, on who Nick Zappo, that's his real name, on who Nick Zappo is. And I would encourage everybody to seek it out. If you've never even heard of Zicky Dice, well, you don't know what a Zicky Dice even is. I thought when I first saw him on TV weeks ago, he was Sticky, or not Sticky Dice. I thought he was Ziggy Dice. Sticky Dice could have a very different meaning. So I didn't know really anything about the guy. He just looked like, you know, a generic annoying heel who was in there to probably lose a whole bunch of matches. And then I watched this video and I gained a newfound respect for the guy. So if you want to watch it, just go on YouTube, search Nick Zappo Indeed on YouTube. It should be the first thing that comes up. I love little features like that that just let you into who these people really are. So at least you have some kind of background and it's not a complete mystery. Although sometimes you want it to be a complete mystery, right? Especially if it's like a really scary monster heel. Like imagine if Kane in 1997 had come onto the scene, right? Looking the way he did, all scary looking. But if Twitter existed and YouTube and all these social media platforms and the internet existed then as it does now, if I just jumped on YouTube that night and I found a video on like monster.com about Glenn Jacobs being a part-time, you know, teaching politics at like the local school and helping out at a soup kitchen, that would have killed Kane for me pretty much early on. So some guys, I think it's scarier if you just don't know anything about their background. But this was still a well-done video. Tim Storm was out for his match in the main event with Nick Aldis. Aldis, though, he walks out in dress pants with the rest of his group. He's now calling them Strictly Business. That's the name of the group. We have the Inner Circle in AEW, and here now we have Strictly Business in the NWA. He said he entered the TV title tournament for fun. Tim Storm, though, has taken the fun out of it for him. And he said, in his place, I'm not going to wrestle, but in my place, Royce Isaacs of the Wild Cards. You'll take my place. And that kind of caught Isaacs by surprise, but, you know, he wanted to impress his new love, who is back out there with him again this week, Mae Valentine, who was out there with the rest of the group. And shout out to Andrew for finding me. I told you last week, I couldn't find this woman's real name. I couldn't find anything about her. And Andrew wrote into me and said, I have her real name, and he shared it with me. It's Mayra Diaz Gomez. I looked her up. She is apparently a Brazilian model. She is an author. And she has worked also as a journalist. And her name was also mentioned, I saw, in connection with a casting call early last year for a new WWE reality show called The Superstar Search, where they search the world, I guess, for the next big female star. So basically a modern-day diva search. I guess it went nowhere. She was there for the casting call. This was last January, so a year ago. And I've not heard anything about this new show since then. She must not have either. Which is why she's now in the NWA. Storm won a decent little match with his perfect Storm finish. It's the old boss man slam, but with a twirl. It's kind of similar to Corbin's deep six, but not as impressive. The nice thing about these TV title tournament matches is that they can't go longer than 6 minutes and 5 seconds. That is the time limit on every single one of these tournament matches. It's 6:05. So there's a sense of urgency to them. All this was outside the ring. He was not happy when all of a sudden the Rock and Roll Express, they walked up behind him. And when he turned around, Ricky Morton was there and he told him, "Don't ever turn your back on your opponent." And then Ricky looked to the crowd and he started to get the crowd to chant Rock and Roll. And we got Into the Fire to end the show. I'll try to do that every week at the end of this review because it's just appropriate, right? That's how these shows end. That's how these shows end, before the credits roll, right? They start playing that awesome theme song. They start playing Dokken, and you hear, "Into the Fire!" And then they roll the clips, you know? And then you see William Patrick Morgan or Corgan, whatever the fuck his name is. We'll call him William Patrick Morgan this week, and David Lagana, and then you see all the credits as the music plays. So it's a catchy theme song. I love it. I like their theme. It might be the best theme song on any wrestling TV show going today. Is the one on NWA Power. I don't think Storm is winning the TV title. I think he gets screwed out of it somehow. He's going to be challenging for that 10 pounds of gold again soon enough. They'll find some way around it, just like they will with Cody and AEW not being able to ever again challenge for the AEW title. Yeah, okay. No Marty Scurll, though, on this show this week. Not even a mention. So if he is going to challenge Aldis for the championship at their Hard Times pay-per-view on the 24th, he's going to need to get back on the show soon to lay down the gauntlet. They're going to have to make it official in some way. I just realized that's the day that I get back from that Jericho cruise. That night is an NWA pay-per-view. My God. Oh, my God. And then that weekend is Worlds Collide and then the Royal Rumble. Shoot me. Just shoot me. Just shoot me. Oh, my God. So, yeah, NWA has Hard Times. Impact's got Hard to Kill next weekend. WWE is Hard to Watch every week. And if Zelina Vega wears what she wore again on Raw last week, those won't be the only things that are hard. Oh, would you look at that? It's time for this week's RSPW Rewind, and not a moment too soon. This is the first rewind of the new decade, and it is taking us back 27 years to a time long before Liv Morgan professed her love for Lana, and King Corbin smeared dog food all over Roman Reigns, although the fans complained every bit as much back then. We begin with Andy Patrizio's post on June 23rd, 1993. So this would have been about 10 days, I think, after the very first King of the Ring pay-per-view. This was a post titled WCW Bashers. He said, "Let's look at some of the things WCW has done lately. Ridiculed the mentally ill with their Cactus Jack search. Ridiculed homelessness with said search. Promoted blatant sexism with Fifi the Maid and some of the 900 hotline messages that Ric Flair and Arn Anderson have been doing. Brought in blatant steroid abusers like Sid Udy and Davey Boy Smith. Did an angle last Saturday where Sid and Vader tried to kill Sting in front of a group of kids. Ah, yes. This was the Beach Blast mini-movie that cost WCW, I think it was about, it was something like $80,000 or like almost $100,000. It cost them to film this little mini-movie where Cheatham the Midget tried to blow up Sting on a boat before Davey Boy Smith rescued him. It was an angle so horrible that Jim Cornette, he begged Dave Meltzer at the time to quote him on this, too. He actually wanted to be identified and quoted in the Observer at the time. And I looked it up because I remember it was just something so... It was exactly what you would expect Jim Cornette to say. And this is what he had to say at the time about this angle, about this movie. "Anybody responsible for that fucking abomination should not only be shot, but be forced to watch it over and over again until they puke up their toenails before being shot." So I see Cornette has not calmed down much in his older years from the things he was saying 27 years ago. At least he's consistent. At least he's consistent. Although I don't know why somebody would puke up their toenails. That just seems very odd to me. Andy continues about the list of things WCW has done. WCW announced Bobby Eaton and Chris Benoit would be on the cards when they know damn well the two of them are in Japan. This is false advertising and a criminal offense. WCW destroyed their relationship with New Japan Pro Wrestling by letting Vader go to UWFI and making Sasuke a jobber. Let go of no talents, like Robbie V and Shane Douglas, while hiring Dick Slater, JYD, and Sid. I assume he was being sarcastic by calling Robbie V and Shane Douglas no talents. Continued the tradition of race mimicking by making an American an Asian wrestler when New Japan has an overflow of talent. And on, this Fed is a mess. The worst thing we can bitch about when it comes to the WWF is a lack of effort and sloppy wrestling. Even that was cleaned up with King of the Ring and a wrestling show was done, as Meltzer pointed out this week. Maybe the Ross Lawler influence will help. That's interesting. Somebody talking about the Jerry Lawler, Jim Ross influence back in 1993, before they were even an announced team together. But the WWF, he says, is always consistent, whereas WCW is all over the place, like horse shit in a parade. For every complaint we've had about WWF tastelessness, WCW has tried to outdo them, rather than take the high, noble road. Well, let me tell you, let me stop there. If you're looking for someone in wrestling to take the high, noble road, you're going to be waiting an awfully long time. I don't think this is an industry that has traditionally, especially back in 93, been built on much in the way of nobility. But I say that as a fan on the outside looking in. It says, rather than refuse to sink to that level, WCW tries to go deeper. Bischoff is an idiot, while Ole and Dusty are just plain clueless. Those two couldn't book Wing or FMW. Ted Turner would be wise to pick up Smoky Mountain Wrestling and drop WCW. Well, thank God he didn't do that. Thank God he did. Who is this, Andy? Thank God he didn't take Andy's advice. It's a reason why people like Ted Turner don't take advice from people on forums like RSPW. Or I guess these days it would be Reddit or something like that. Thank God for that. Here's a post from Bill on December 8th, 1993, titled RSPW Please to Vince. It has been suggested many times that Vince McMahon or his staff monitors RSPW. All right, well, if true, let's make a direct and clear plea to Mr. McMahon on certain issues. Here are some. Issue number one. Use the talent which you have in the ranks. For example, Barry Horowitz is a quite talented... Let me compose myself here. Barry Horowitz is a quite talented wrestler. Give him a shave, a face turn, and a new outfit. He can see the light as the winner. That could be his new name. He's the winner. He can make his face turn interesting, or make his face turn by interfering in a 1-2-3 kid match to help the kid. Then you can use Barry in singles matches as well as with the kid in tag team matches. All right, so he's a Barry Horowitz mark, it appears. I can't say that I've stumbled across too many of those in my RSPW searching, so that's a first. Number two, a little more wrestling time on air, a little less pay-per-view hype each week. Showcase the real talent more than you are presently doing, and please, less endless intro videos. Unless Double J is going to sing or play soon, this line is wearing thin. You know, it's a shame because we don't get a lot like these days in wrestling. We don't see event center updates on the shows. Like, we used to get them with Mean Gene and Sean Mooney and Todd Pettengill, where they would throw it to the, quote, event center, and they would run down some of the matches on the upcoming pay-per-view, where they would throw it to some promos, you know, hyping up matches on the pay-per-view. It's just very different now. And, you know, AEW has a control center, and Tony Schiavone hosts. We don't see those segments on Dynamite, though. So I guess the reason they don't do it is because people tune out, you know, which is why I laugh when people say, oh, ratings don't matter. Okay, well, and then you're an idiot. If that's what you honestly believe, you're a fool. And one of the reasons they don't do segments like that on TV is because it affects the numbers and because people tune out, and they don't find event centers very appealing. I happen to think that they're very beneficial to the people who actually watch the freaking show week to week. But I guess they have to serve all audiences, and if it's driving off people from watching the show, then I guess we don't get event center updates. We get Twitter updates. That's what we get. That's where we have evolved to here. 27 years later. There's no more event center updates. There's no more rundowns. You get the very quick rundown by the announcers, I guess, at the desk, and that's the extent of it. It's too bad. Number three. Some first-rate talent in the announcing booth is important. Macho Man doesn't cut it. A Jim Ross is great at straight announcing, and a Bobby Heenan or Jesse Ventura are great contrast announcers from the heel perspective. A smashing sense of humor in the booth is great as well. Bobby Heenan will be missed by most of the RSPW readers. That's right. This is when Bobby had just been thrown out of Monday Night Raw by Gorilla Monsoon. Actually, one of the more emotional segments that I can ever remember seeing in Raw history. And you could see Bobby tear up there at the end of the segment, and we never did see him again until, I guess it would have been the gimmick Battle Royal, WrestleMania in 2001. Number four. Drop the low talents or job them. It was wise to not give Lex Luger the title. He has no real talent in wrestling. Like Hogan, he is a two-moves wrestler. Some fans do like Lex, so I have this suggestion. Send him to wrestling school. If he refuses, it is jobber status or exile to the boonies. Can you imagine a guy that looks like Lex Luger did, making the kind of money I'm sure he was making, a world champion in other promotions, doesn't know enough moves, so we're shipping him off to wrestling school? As if that's the reason he was even hired in the first place. I mean, come on. These people are delirious. I'd love to be a fly on the wall for that conversation. You think Vince McMahon would have had that conversation with Lex? He probably would have sent, like, J.J. Dillon to do it, right? Hey, J.J., go talk to Lex. Tell him we're going to send him to wrestling school. He's going to go work with Vern Gagne or something at his wrestling school. Go give him the good news. We're going to send him to the dojo. We're going to send him off to, like, a New Japan dojo somewhere or something. Oh, my God. He says, I urge you that any face champion have superior wrestling skills, the quality of a Ted DiBiase. Any heel champion should either sell evil, a la Killer Kowalski, or good wrestling skills used for evil purposes. Man, this person's given this a lot of thought. He says, if a wrestler's forte is a kick to the face, or a bear hug, or a roll-up, then he needs to go to school. You know, today, I guess the equivalent would be if they can't do a good enough super kick, or a tope suicida. Off to wrestling camp they go. But he was not finished yet. This person was not finished yet. Number five. Today's portable video cameras make it quite important that wrestling moves be done well. Teach your wrestlers to not sell badly missed moves. That's right, you hear that? Will Ospreay and Hiromu? Wrestle Kingdom the other night? That drop kick off the top rope? That's right, this person's talking to you two guys. He says, you may fool the people in the auditorium, but that television camera very often catches the miss and subsequent sell. Today's high tech quite often makes your show look bad. That is, of course, what he's talking about, is the high technology of 1993 that he is referring to. So basically, what I'm getting out of this post is push Barry Horowitz and send half of your roster back to wrestling school. That's the moral of the story. This next post was published on September 30th, 1994, by Brian Graupman, Observations About RSPW. No replies, it's just the one post by one author. It says, I've been reading this group for a while now. I read it for news about talent movement and what happened on various shows. I do not follow most of the threads that get started for more than a couple of posts because they usually deteriorate into the insert fed name, wrestler name, or promoter name sucks, and I'll never watch it again kind of discussions after that. I have watched pro wrestling off and on since I was a kid. Some of my earliest memories are of a show that I believe was called something like Big Time Wrestling with Lord Athol Layton doing the announcing. I guess I always knew the match outcomes were scripted, but I enjoyed watching for the action and the idea that the good guys would almost always win out over the heels. I sometimes find it funny how some of the posters to this group, while claiming to be smart fans, blast away at the other major federations, or at the major federations, about the way they put the shows together. You expect them, primarily the WWF and WCW, to book things exactly as you want them to be. You forget that the target market for the WWF and WCW is not smart fans, it is families with kids and disposable income. Because of this, the WWF has a lot of cartoony characters, and WCW went out and signed the most recognizable name in the world of wrestling. Because of this, you can get a giant foam hand with Hulkamania painted on it, or Bret Hart shades, or a foam Undertaker urn, or any other number of kids' items. There are 900-number wrestling hotlines that cost $5 for a 3-minute call. Kids, get your parents' permission. The programming and the merchandising is aimed at people under the age of 16. If you expect the wrestling promotions in North America to do any differently, you will rarely have your expectations met. Now, maybe ECW will become the federation that will provide smart fans with the kind of programming that they may want to see. But with television stations throughout the U.S. and Canada dropping wrestling, ECW may not be able to get the kind of exposure on a national level that it will need to grow into anything more than a small regional promotion. Pro wrestling on the whole is in a downward slide right now. There are probably many reasons for this. I know that I am too busy to watch much of it anymore. I used to be able to watch 6 to 8 hours of wrestling every weekend. WWF, NWA, UWF, and for a little TNA, GLOW. Now I'm lucky if I get to watch Raw on Mondays. If you don't like what they're showing, turn it off. Don't watch it. Check it out from time to time to see if it's better. Read RSPW for any news that might come out and wait for the next upswing. It will happen, and probably long after Hogan is gone and Ric Flair will be doing Bobby Heenan shtick commentary for some promotion. We end with a controversial post. Got a lot of replies from Fitz3860 from September 7th, 1997, so we're skipping ahead a few years, titled ECW Fans, The Blood Will Be on Your Hands. When Sandman and Mahoney and the rest of these ECW wrestlers end up with brain damage and chronic pain and injuries, you people are responsible for supporting their fate. First of all, the wrestlers themselves are idiots and deserve any long-term health troubles they may have, because everyone knows that taking full-force chair shots to the head and going through 4 tables is not healthy. These morons do it anyway. Well, Fitz just countered the argument there from a lot of wrestlers that they simply did not know the long-term effects of being hit in the head repeatedly with steel chairs. Oh, we didn't know. I always love hearing that argument. We didn't know. How can we know? Who knew that bashing somebody in the head with a metal object would cause potential brain damage? Who knew? Fitz continues. But for these fans to support this, you are sick people. You encourage this mutilation, such as the barbed wire match, with all of those stitches that are needed. You people were talking about how great a match it was. It was despicable. These wrestlers, and you put that in quotes, these wrestlers, and I use that term lightly, should not be encouraged and cheered for how they can take chair shots. This mentality of ECW that a real man can take a chair shot, like the Sandman Mahoney thing, is absolutely sick. Anyone who supports this has major mental problems just as much as these stupid wrestlers who do this to themselves. Put guys like Mankind and those FMW idiots into this group of ECW moron wrestlers. You fans are partly to blame and you know it. ECW sucks. Wow. So, Fitz, tell us how you really feel. So that was Fitz. And then Ryan Mulder says, ECW sucks. Fine. You don't like it? Don't watch it. I don't like WWF or WCW, but I don't go around talking smack about them. Fitz replies, yeah, right. You're telling us that Joey Styles never goes on ECW television and rips on WCW or rips on WWF? Are you seriously claiming that ECW fans here don't rip on WCW and WWF? ECW fans are such elitist wannabe smarts who think they're better than wrestling fans of other feds. I think they're sickos who support violence and sexism. That is the truth. And finally, KCloth5647 responded. He jumped into the debate here. He said, Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit, and Perry Saturn. Those guys don't seem to be in too bad of a shape. Well, about that. That might be some bad examples for K-Cloth here to be citing, in retrospect. But anyway, K-Cloth continues. He says, let me just say that I met Sandman, and he was brain damaged long before this hardcore thing began. Now, clearly in this post, Fitz had an agenda. He was no fan of ECW, that much is obvious. But a lot of those ECW guys, you know, not all of them, there's still quite a few of them around, but a lot of them, you know, did end up either dead or in rough shape, and they had drug problems, and, you know, sometimes it's hard to say cause and effect as far as what led to led to the other. But for every one of those guys, there's a Tommy Dreamer, or there's a Bubba Ray Dudley, or Rob Van Dam, or a Mikey Whipwreck. And I know Mikey's been beat up, but they're all doing pretty well, all things considered, you know, and they're still active in some cases. You know, do the fans have blood on their hands? If they went to those old shows, yeah, probably. And on their face, and their arms, and their chest. probably have blood on a lot of parts of their body if you were in those old crowds. So this has been your weekly reminder that if Bill was still around, he would be sending a lot of talent back to wrestling school and putting Barry Horowitz in the Hall of Fame. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from if you would like to possibly be part of the mailbag each week. Now, last week, during the RSPW Rewind, I talked about the WWF Full Metal album that came out in 1996, and how it always irked me that the version of Shawn Michaels' theme song that they used sounded a little bit different than the arena version of his music. And I heard from a few people who agreed with me, including Hishem, who's a musician. He's a composer, which means he's also an audiophile. So if anyone's going to pick up on this kind of stuff, it's him. He's been a listener of the show for years and years now. He said, "So funny, your sexy boy theme song experience is exactly what I went through as a kid. As you were telling your story, I can nearly predict everything you are going to say. I got Full Metal and was so excited for the HBK theme song, only for it to come back so muddy. It was mixed awfully. Sure enough, I went through the settings in the In Your House PlayStation game, and that version, as you said, was so much more full, crisp, and had way more life to it. So funny how you picked up on that as well." I had Robert on Twitter said, "I absolutely know what you meant when you were talking about Shawn Michaels' theme music. It annoyed me forever." So, clearly I'm not the only one who heard a difference between the way the song sounded on CD and the way it sounded usually on TV. But I got an email from Cliff, who said that he listened to the Full Metal version and he compared it to the arena version, who said, "Now, you know," he said, "it's the same vocals and the same instrumentation." Now, let me clarify. I was not saying it's a different song or that the vocals are different. It's someone else singing it, or they have two versions of Shawn singing. I didn't say that. But there were some changes made to it that make it sound worse, in my opinion, than the arena version. And so, since we may have some people listening thinking to themselves, "What the hell is he talking about?" I want to play both versions for you. Not the whole song, but I want to play both versions for you. I want to let you guys decide if I'm crazy or not. Who's right and who's wrong? I'm going to play a sample of both, back to back. And then you can chime in and you can let me know if you hear any difference. Okay, we're gonna find out. This is a good little experiment here. Because people sometimes, they hear different things. Even sometimes people see different things. I always say, like, if you ask 10 witnesses to an event or a car crash or something, "Hey, what did you see?" You may end up with 10 different versions of what happened. So I want to see if people hear what I'm hearing when I listen to these two songs. So we'll start here with a cut from the Full Metal album. Here's the Full Metal version of the song that was released back in 96.
"I think I'm cute. I know I'm sexy. I've got the look that drives the girls wild. I've got the move that really move them. I said chill up and down their spine. I'm just a sexy boy. I'm not your boy, toy."
Okay, so that's the inferior version. Here's the actual song that you hear every time Shawn Michaels comes out to the ring.
"I think I'm cute. I know I'm sexy. I've got the look that drives the girls wild. I've got the move that really move them. I said chill up and down their spine. I'm just a sexy boy. I'm not your boy toy.
just the sexy boy. I'm sorry. It's a catchy tune. What can I say? So, you heard both versions. Same song. But there is clearly an audible difference between these two, yes? Have I lost my mind? And why would they do this, is what I'm wondering. I've never understood why they would not just release the arena-used version, whatever speed or tempo or whatever it is. I could never understand why they had two different versions and why the one that I found on the In Your House game sounded the way that it did there at the end, and that the Full Metal one sounded the way that that one did. It never made any sense to me. But anyway, you guys can chime in and you can let me know if I'm absolutely out of my mind. Mosin from Mississauga says he was with an ex-WWE writer recently who asked him what he would think if Finn Balor won the Royal Rumble. He says, I feel like he was testing me since it was so random and I didn't think much of it at the time because I wasn't really interested in him winning. In retrospect, he could be a solid contender as a surprise and, most importantly, part of the NXT brand. Maybe as Demon Finn. What do you think? I think it would be an interesting choice. Nobody is really talking about Finn Balor right now. His stint in NXT was never, I don't think, meant to be a permanent thing. But he still hasn't had that payoff match against Johnny Gargano, who just came back. So if they're saving that match for the February TakeOver show, I think it's like February 16th or something, there's a standalone NXT TakeOver event. If they're saving that match, that first match between them for that show, and again, Balor right now is a heel, him winning the Rumble, and then let's say he got to choose which champion he wanted to face, and we still don't know what the rules are going to be for the Rumble this year, but if he got to choose the champion he wanted to face, and let's say he picked The Fiend to challenge at WrestleMania, it would be weird if he was still playing heel and feuding with Gargano on NXT television. You know, if they blow it off before the Rumble, let's say on NXT in 2 weeks or something, we're going to get a Finn Balor-Johnny Gargano match. And, you know, he loses. I assume he probably would be losing on his way out of NXT. If they blow it off, then I would think that he would be a solid prediction for the Royal Rumble as far as a potential winner in the men's match this year. You know, he's popular. He's still a popular guy, and we never got Demon Finn against the Finn. I'm going to call him the Fiend, Bray Wyatt from now on. We never got Demon Finn against the Fiend after the Fiend beat him at SummerSlam last year. You know, Roman Reigns against the Fiend, that seems to be the prevailing thought right now for WrestleMania 36, that Roman is going to be the one to get the shot. Maybe he doesn't even win the Royal Rumble, but he's going to go on to WrestleMania. Maybe he'll win the Chamber or something, and he's going to wrestle the Fiend and be the first possibly to beat the Fiend and win the WWE Championship, or I guess the Universal Championship. That seems to be the betting line right now. What do you think? You know, would you rather see Demon Balor be the man to wrestle the Fiend at WrestleMania, or beat the Fiend at WrestleMania, or would you prefer Roman Reigns? I honestly could go either way. Roman has been out of the title picture long enough that I might be okay with it. You know, but he had a whole string of WrestleMania main events already. Only one of which I thought was any good. The match with Brock Lesnar, their first match at WrestleMania 31, I thought was excellent. The match with Triple H at WrestleMania 32 was a dud. The match with The Undertaker at WrestleMania 33 was a dud. The match with Brock at WrestleMania 34 was a dud. You know, this past year, he was not in the main event. He had a very quick, not particularly memorable match with Drew McIntyre in his first big match back since the cancer stuff. But he doesn't exactly have this sterling track record of WrestleMania main events that blew people away or felt like, you know, they were really that big of a deal. So I personally would like to see somebody else get that spot. You know, I can appreciate that they've kept him out of the title scene for a year or however long it's been, but let somebody else get a chance, a fresher face to be in that spot on that show. In the end, what does it all boil down to? It all boils down to how compelling the story is that they come up with. If they want to put Roman Reigns in that match against The Fiend, come up with a compelling story. They have history together. He and Bray once had a great match at Hell in a Cell, but that was Bray Wyatt. That was not The Fiend. The Fiend's matches have not really been anything terribly exciting so far. But Balor is an idea that I hadn't really thought about, but in some ways it can make a whole lot of sense, especially if they wanted to get Balor back on Raw or SmackDown and follow up on that little bit of history that he has with that Fiend character, because he never really did come back and get his revenge, and we did not see the demon. Maybe this time we do. Chase Pac, I'd love to hear you talk about Kenny Omega. I've been a wrestling fan for well over 30 years, and I've heard all about him via podcasts and websites, but I've never seen him wrestle other than a few YouTube clips here and there, until AEW began. I don't get it. The best thing about him on AEW is that he comes across as one of the bigger stars because the crowd goes nuts when he comes out, but that's about it. I don't like the exaggerated pointing thing he does with his finger like he's aiming at a target. The way he runs the ropes, starting and then slowing down and then running super fast, is very annoying. He drops guys on their head all the time. And like everybody else, he doesn't sell at all. Or if he does, he suddenly recovers to hit some improbable move. And he does lots of dives. Big deal. He's very cartoony, almost overacting at times, and he does tons of pausing to play to the crowd. He doesn't seem to be much of a talker, and he has pretty much no personality. Tell me why everyone loves him so much, because given what I've heard, I've been expecting 6-star matches every time, and I haven't seen one yet. And in case you read this on the podcast and listeners are yelling into their phones, this guy is a moron. Did he not see the 6-man with the Bucks against the Lucha Bros and Pac this week? Yes, I saw that, and it sucked. No story, no selling, everyone doing the same flips and rope walking and springboard, all the same maneuvers, don't sell, repeat, don't sell, repeat. Thanks, Solid Monster, you're the best. I think this is one of those situations where it boils down to your matter of personal preference. A lot of the things that you just described in your email, in terms of the lack of selling, or in terms of doing a lot, a lot of moves where people get dropped on their heads, and doing a lot of dives, and doing a lot of flips, and that is hardly something that is reserved just for Kenny Omega. It sounds to me like you would not be a fan, if you watch week to week, you would not be a fan of the AEW show. Because I think even more on AEW Dynamite than the WWE shows, you tend to see a lot of that in a lot of the matches. It could be from the Lucha Bros, from the Young Bucks, from a lot of different people. Kenny Omega is hardly the only person who is guilty of that. So I just think in that case, it boils down to your personal preference. I don't think I can show you much that Kenny Omega has done, based on what you've said here, that I think you would really enjoy. I would point you to the matches with Okada in New Japan. But I will tell you that there's moves that end up not being sold. There's a lot of kickouts. There's a lot of dropping people on their heads and moves that'll make you cringe every now and then. So you may not like that either, but you talked about 6-star matches, the whole star system, All these aspiring astronomers out there who love all the stars in the sky said that during my Wrestle Kingdom review. I don't rate things usually on the star scale, but I will say, I picked it as my, match of the year when it happened. It's one of the best matches I can ever remember seeing. It was a long match, but it was over an hour long, I think. But the match that he had where he finally beat Okada, and he won the championship, and I think that was the 2 out of 3 falls one. There was a story there. If you're into storytelling and psychology and things of that nature, there was a story there being told. From all their previous matches and certain things they tried and moves they did, there was a story being told. I would refer you to that. I would refer you to the series of matches that he had with Okada as some of the best work that he has ever done. And I'll even refer you back to the match he had with Hiroshi Tanahashi at Wrestle Kingdom last year. 1 year ago. Fantastic match. They told a little bit of a story going into it about why they didn't like each other. And then they went out there and they had this outstanding wrestling match. It just may not be a style that you're into, but I would definitely give those a watch. See if that changes your mind. I'm not convinced that it will. Omega does do some of the things you mentioned there. He can be very cartoony in his reactions. I was just talking about that today on the podcast at the beginning, remember, when I was talking about Tessa Blanchard, who I think is rocking it and doing her thing in Impact, and I think she's going to be a big star for many years to come. But if I had one knock on her, it's these overreactions when somebody kicks out of one of her moves. It's cartoon-esque. It takes me out of the moment. And there's a lot of people. She and Omega and Will Ospreay, they're hardly the only ones who are guilty of that. So I will give you that. He can be very cartoony. To say that he has no personality, though, I just think they haven't done a good job of letting his personality fully shine through. To say he has no personality is just ridiculous, though. Yeah, if you look around at some of the Being the Elite stuff on YouTube, and I mean, obviously, if you look at earlier in his career when he was doing some of those ridiculous matches in DDT in Japan, where he literally wrestled a blow-up doll. Had a pretty good match with the blow-up doll, too, all things considered. But he wrestled the blow-up doll. He wrestled the blow-up doll. He wrestled a 9-year-old girl who's a better wrestler than some of the people who are on TV today, who I shall not name. These are all things he did earlier in his career that is a big part of why people like Jim Cornette hate this guy's guts and will never respect him no matter what he accomplishes and achieves in his career. And he's accomplished a lot. He's gone from basically a comedy wrestler to being somebody who was on top of the world and the world champion, at the Tokyo Dome. That's a big deal. In AEW, I will tell you, he has not had any of these supposed 5 or 6 star matches. He's had some pretty good ones. He had a match with Shima last year. Some people really love that lights out hardcore match he had with Jon Moxley. I really wasn't one of them. I have yet to see Kenny Omega have a match in AEW like he had in New Japan Pro Wrestling. It's just two different shows, two different styles. We have yet to see that. I agree. We have not seen that Kenny Omega yet in AEW. I have not been blown away by a lot that I have seen from him in AEW. And it's a different ballgame now. You're on weekly television. This would have been the same thing if he would have signed with WWE. You were never going to get that Kenny Omega from New Japan. You're just not going to get it. The AJ Styles that we saw in New Japan. Look at the AJ's body of work in WWE. He's had a lot of tremendous matches. The series of matches with John Cena. I thought some of the matches with Nakamura were actually disappointing. They seemed to get progressively better towards the end of their feud in 2018 between AJ and Shinsuke. But, he's had some feuds and matches, frankly, that have been very disappointing. Not just with Nakamura, with Kevin Owens. It's a different AJ Styles than, and he's older now too, but it's a different AJ Styles than the one we saw killing it with Okada and people like that in New Japan. Minoru Suzuki and some of these great matches that AJ had when he was over there. Right now, today in WWE, even AJ Styles, as good as he is, I don't see him having those kinds of matches anymore. It's very, very hit or miss. But I think the whole weekly television thing has a lot to do with that. Back then, Omega would have this huge match. He would have weeks and weeks or a few months to prepare for it. He wasn't having matches on television like that every week. I don't know that you're ever going to see a 5 or 6 star Kenny Omega match on an AEW show. You may never see that. Now, it's still early, right? Dynamite's only been on the air for a couple months or 3 months, whatever it's been. They don't have pay-per-views every month. They have pay-per-views, I think, 4 times a year. So we'll see. I mean, I think you make some valid points. I'm not quite as harsh on the guy as you are. But I think you've heard all of these things about him, but it was almost like a different Kenny Omega than the one we've been exposed to in AEW. It's almost unfair, I think, to judge it in that way. You make some valid points. I would say if you want to see what he's capable of, if you want to see some of what I think is his best work, even beyond the Okada matches, go find some of those New Japan matches that he had. And maybe just read up on what the story was going into them. That'll give you some context. And you'll see what he's, in the ring, what he's physically capable of. We really haven't seen him realize that potential yet in AEW. Ben from Rhode Island, what do you make of the original lineup for WrestleMania 30 that CM Punk shared on his Instagram story this week? Do you think it looks better or worse than what we ended up getting? Oh, it looks far worse. I did see that. I did see the photo of what I guess was a run sheet. It had a date on it of January 20th, 2014, which I believe would have been before the Royal Rumble, which is, the day after is when Punk walked out. So, if it's accurate, and if that's what he has a copy of, I don't know why he would still have a copy of that, but if it's accurate, and this is what the card was going to be, I think we dodged a bullet. I think him walking out actually ended up, the way the card was reshuffled, made WrestleMania a much better show that year. And it's funny because that turned out, in my opinion, to be one of the better WrestleManias that they have ever done. And one of the best WrestleManias, probably the best. I will say the best WrestleMania of the decade. Even more than 31. WrestleMania 30 was the best WrestleMania of the decade. And it almost didn't happen. You know, you look at what was on that paper. It has Randy Orton against Batista for the World Heavyweight Championship in the main event. We already knew that. We knew Batista was coming back at the Royal Rumble. He was probably going to win. And it was going to be him as the babyface going in there and beating Randy Orton for the championship at WrestleMania. And he'd have a run for a few months or 6 months or whatever before he would disappear and go back to Hollywood. That was the rumor. That was the reported idea at the time. So that being the main event is hardly a surprise. CM Punk against Triple H. Again, we knew that was going to be the match had Punk not walked out. That was a big part of why he walked out. CM Punk and Triple H was going to be kind of second from the top. Undertaker and Brock Lesnar, which we ended up getting. John Cena against Bray Wyatt, which didn't do Bray Wyatt any favors. That match ended up happening. Those are the only two matches listed on there that actually ended up happening. They also listed Big Show against Kane and Roman Reigns. This is interesting. Roman Reigns meeting Dean Ambrose, challenging Ambrose for the United States Championship. Now, on the actual event, The Shield had a throwaway, like, three-minute tag team match against Kane and the New Age Outlaws. And The Big Show was in the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal, which was the first one, which ended up being won by Cesaro. And that is one of those all-time memorable WrestleMania moments when Cesaro lifted The Big Show up in that body slam position. And he walked for about 2 seconds. He walked with him over to the ropes. You could see everybody in the dome there, where they were in New Orleans, in the Superdome, rise to their feet. And he dumped Big Show out to the floor, and the place exploded. It had to be the highlight moment of Cesaro's career in WWE. That one slam on the Giant and winning the big trophy, having his WrestleMania moment, it was huge. These people reacted to him like they had just made a new superstar, which makes me even more depressed when I think back on that moment and what might have been and how far could he have gone? How far could they have gone if they weren't scared shitless or just Nimrods? I mean, whatever the explanation was, to do more than they did with Cesaro. So that was the card as it was originally listed, and they also on there had Daniel Bryan against Sheamus, and Bryan talked about this in his book. He was told that he was going to be fifth or sixth down on the card in a match with Sheamus, who he had wrestled so many times before. They wrestled it for the 18-second match at WrestleMania. The year before that, they were supposed to have a dark match, not even be on the show. I mean, now they were going to wrestle again. As hot as he was, they were going to have him fifth or sixth from the top against Sheamus. If that doesn't tell you where these people's heads were so far buried up their own asses, I don't know what does. That looks like a horrible card for WrestleMania. So yeah, we dodged a bullet. We dodged a huge bullet. Because once Punk walked out and they lost the match with Triple H, Triple H needed something new. So they recalibrated. Between that and people shitting on Batista at the Royal Rumble, Bryan got over and Punk walked out, and that's why we ended up with the WrestleMania that we ended up with, and it just so happened that it turned out to be one of the best shows that they ever did, with this great story that started at the beginning of the show, and it culminated with that main event championship win. And by the way, also on that show, we had, if you remember, the show opened with this legendary segment with three of the biggest names in the history of the business, and the two biggest stars in the history of WWE, Hulk Hogan and Stone Cold Steve Austin. And then The Rock came out. It's kind of weird talking about The Rock like an afterthought, but if you were going to rank who are the top names, the biggest stars in WWE history, you can order them any which way you want to. It's Austin and Hogan. And you could say, you could put Hogan 1, Austin 2, Austin 1, Hogan 2. Everyone's going to have their opinion. Some people would say it's not fair. It's The Rock. The Rock is number one. The Rock is not number one. I don't think The Rock is number one. You could make that argument, but I believe it's Hogan and Austin. There's never been two bigger stars in wrestling in this company, at least in WWE, than Hulk Hogan and Stone Cold Steve Austin. I don't believe The Rock. I don't believe John Cena. Roman Reigns, Bret Hart, who I love, but not Bret Hart, not Shawn Michaels. It's Hogan and Austin. And you had all three of these guys sharing the ring together for a segment and sharing a beer at the end of the segment. It was this great moment. I mean, aside from Hogan calling it the Silver Dome, which was great because then Austin, you know, ribbed him for it when he came out, which was just fantastic. That show from top to bottom, pretty much. Even Undertaker and Lesnar, I thought the match was shit because Undertaker got his bell rung. But then you had that moment at the end where the streak ended. And it was like, I've never seen a crowd so paralyzed in my life, not knowing how to react. Like, they could not believe what they just saw. I've not seen a match ending elicit that kind of reaction in my entire life. So, I think we ended up with the better show. I think that's safe to say. But that's pretty cool that Punk still had a copy of that. And makes you wonder, what else does he have a copy of? What else is he hiding from us? Sean on Twitter, we'll end with this. Can we please get a history of Norman Smiley? Now, he sent me this tweet weeks ago. I just didn't have a chance to get to it, and I felt bad. But he said, can we get a history of Norman Smiley? It seems like he's done a lot in the business for longer than I thought, and I wondered if you would know more about him. That's Norman Smiley to you. You got to say it right. It's Norman Smiley. Any WCW watchers know what I'm talking about there. Everybody at the Performance Center raves about Norman Smiley. He's been coaching there now in some form or fashion since the year that I started this podcast. That's how long he's been a coach there for. It's going all the way back to the FCW days. But he spent a lot of years in Mexico. He was a world champion in CMLL. He was largely a job guy in WCW for a few years. And then he started to develop a little bit of a cult following. And he became their first ever hardcore champion. He had this big signature move, the big wiggle that he became known for. You know, he's largely played for comedy, but he actually ended up having some success, you know. But his influence and his respect now, it doesn't stem from those days. It stems largely from all the years. I mean, people respect his ability as a wrestler, but really, I think when you hear people talk about him, the respect they have for him really stems from the time that he spent with WWE training the next generation of stars. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. Subscribe to the YouTube channel because there's just a ton of stuff, you know, from one week to the next. You never know what's going up on that channel. I should have a part two review of Wrestle Kingdom Day 2 later on tonight after I watch it. And so both parts will be up on YouTube. I do the Dynamite live streams every Wednesday. I do the pay-per-view live streams every month. We'll have one for the Royal Rumble coming up later on this month. Always, sound off inboxes where I jump on video to answer some of your questions that I don't get to here on the show in the mailbag. So a lot of great stuff on the YouTube channel. We are on the cusp very soon of 55,000 subscribers. It wasn't that long ago I hit 50K, a few months ago. So now we're about to hit 55. The only way we do that is if you subscribe to the channel. So please head on over there and do so. Next Sunday, my plan is for next Sunday, episode 634, to be, be the prediction show. I do, you know, the annual predictions every year. I go through the ones last year, see what I got right, see what I got wrong. I'm a little afraid this year to do it, but we'll go through the old ones. We'll have some new predictions for 2020 and all the usual wrestling news and RSPW. It'll be a great time, a grand old time next week on the Sound Off. That'll be Sound Off number 2 of the new decade. Thank you, as always. I will see you later on for the Wrestle Kingdom Part 2 review on YouTube and back here next Sunday. Until then, be well, stay safe, and I'll see you guys again real soon for more Sound Off. Never a shortage of Sound Off content, now more than ever. Got a lot of content being pumped out, and I'm glad you guys seem to be enjoying it. You enjoy it, I'll keep pumping it out. Anyway, I'll see you back here next week, and until then, take care, guys.
The Solemonster sounds off.
Hello.
This is Morrison versus Adam Cole, Morrison versus Finn Balor, Morrison versus Tommaso Ciampa, Morrison versus Keith.
Let me ask you a question. Were you drinking during the pay-per-view tonight?
I would.
Okay, I thought so. See, I thought so. Okay.
The Salamonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Salamonster on Twitter at Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Salamonster Sounds Off.